Good morning, everybody. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Well, they've said for years that space is the final frontier. I think Captain Kirk initially coined that expression, and many people have said it since, and it has the added virtue of being true. So, for people like me who've enjoyed looking up at the night sky and wondering, I love the moment that's happening in our country right now. Because of the anniversary of the Apollo project, because of the space flights of Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos, you're seeing a renewed interest in the space program from government. You're seeing a renewed interest from the media, and you're seeing a renewed interest from the public. And as far as I'm concerned, that is a great thing. And I am just thrilled that we get to spend a full hour exploring some questions related to space with a man who knows about it, more about space than just about anybody that I've spoken to on the radio, and also sounds better than anyone that currently speaks on the radio. I'm talking about Dr. Sky, Steve Cates, a veteran radio and TV broadcaster and edutainer who with a great deal of expertise in astronomy and space. Steve, thank you as always for joining me at this early hour.
Well, Frank, it's a privilege and honor to be here on 77 WABC as we continue to talk about the things that are moving on to the infinite. And how right you are. I mean, this is such an amazing story that continues with the flights and privatization of space. But how about this? A little kick in the pants, something that maybe many people were not aware of. The FAA, right around the time that Jeff Bezos' flight took off with Blue Origin and the new Shepard capsule, they actually made some changes. And I'm kind of concerned about this because what they're doing basically is saying this. They're making a distinction between what a flight crew is and simply what spaceflight participants are. Now, this is kind of, you know, really upsetting the apple cart for many that believe once you go above 50 miles above the Earth, or that classic Kármán line, 60 miles, you would necessarily just get your astronaut wings. But now, the FAA is saying that you'll only be given, that's these guys, and maybe even the Branson flight, but the Branson flight was before the change, that now the people who are participants would probably only get what's called an honorary flight astronaut wing, because flight crews need to demonstrate, get a load of this, activities during flight that are essential to public safety or contributed to space flight safety. And what does that mean in simple English? It means that the travelers that were on board the Bezos flight, all they had to do was sit in the chair and strap in like you're going on an amusement park ride, because the whole flight was autonomous. So the FAA has control of the Commercial Astronaut Wings program. Isn't that interesting?
It is interesting, yeah. And we touched upon this a little bit last week, sure, when you were kind enough to join for a few minutes. But
yes,
the FAA sort of changing the definition of what it means, mm-hmm, to be an astronaut. A lot of people are going to look at that and say, well, look, you have people who've worked their whole lives, who've trained, who've gone,
correct,
through rigorous training process, who've been in the military, who've been scientists, who've been geologists. And they clearly deserve the label of astronaut. Why should someone who plunks down $24 million to be a guest on a space flight where they don't do, mm-hmm, anything, why should that person be given the same distinction as a John Glenn and Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin?
You said it right. That's their way of changing the whole thing. But what's interesting too, Frank, is that the Branson flight, which is a little bit different. I mean, this on their particular spacecraft that's dropped, as people know, from the mothership, it flies into space. But there are two pilots that are piloting this. But once again, in the back, in the passenger area, all you had to do was sit there and enjoy the ride. So if they're going to change this, not to split hairs with the audience here, and then just maybe with the FAA, of course, we're looking at a change that may come. But Branson may slip through the cracks with his. But stay tuned, right, because there's going to be more definitions of this as we move forward. But the big point, and I think that's the one that we have, you know, highlighted last week, what an amazing accomplishment. And that, I think, deserves a lot of attention and congratulations.
Now, I mentioned yesterday as I was promoting your appearance that I was surprised at what's happening with the International Space Station. For starters, I don't think a lot of people in our audience knew that the International Space Station was essentially going to be closing, and they're looking for a private company to do everything that the ISS, or, mm-hmm, formerly the Space Station Mir, used to do. why is the International Space Station closing, and do you see a private company stepping in to fill this void?
Well, the answer to that is pretty simple. The aging of this particular spacecraft, remember, we're looking back in the late 90s when the first modules were put up into and build this, what I call this big Lego block in the sky. And things are getting old, and they've had, as you know, people have reported, and people have heard this through the mainstream media, and on the internet they've read it, that little micrometeor particles have penetrated the hull, they've had oxygen leaks, they've had all kinds of things. But I just want to highlight, Frank, I think this is interesting to share with the audience here. There are literally 10, only 10 humans right now in space. Two Russians on board the International Space Station, one astronaut from France, and of course one from Japan, and three Americans, particularly one woman. But as we continue on with this, there's a module that was actually detached from the International Space Station called the PIRS. It's one of the PIRS. It's one of the older modules that used it's used for experimentation, and they detached it, and they're making room. I don't know if it's attached yet. I mean, I haven't gotten that information yet or intel, but there's something called the Nauka module, which is built in Russia, and it's going to reattach itself. So what I'm saying in simple English is that this particular unit is getting old. They were looking at maybe even turning this into a hotel in space in the future, and that's maybe not out of the question. But new design, see, the Russians are getting very, the Roscosmos, Russian space agency, is starting to have a little political friction with the United States. They've always had a little bit, but more so now with tensions that are going, you know, behind with the State Department and things going on in the political world. The Russians simply want to put up their space station. The Chinese are doing that. There's three Chinese Tikhonauts, as we call them, aboard the Tiangong 1 as it's flying and sailing through space. This particular object has three astronauts, if you want to call that. So I think the simple answer is there's a lot of stuff out there where companies and space agencies want to continue and develop new ones. But on the side of privatization, I wouldn't be surprised if you have people like, you know, Bezos, of course, putting things up. Robert Bigelow wants to put up this inflatable-type, balloon-type space station, a smaller one. But the problem with these things, when they get as big as the International Space Station, it becomes such a big and kind of ungainly thing. And what goes up, Frank, you know, and everybody knows, must come down. And through the program, I wanted to highlight, if we have some time maybe later with your okay, I wanted to give everybody in this audience an opportunity to know of a couple of passages of the International Space Station. One will, of course, occur early tomorrow morning as we move through time and space. And we can go over those, of course, if you want, a little later to describe the times, because some of these passages are incredibly bright. And I know the audience out there, I mean, I get a lot of emails from all the different shows we do, and people are usually, the top thing on their list is, hey, I want to know how to see these space objects that are sailing through the night sky. Well, we pick the big one, the ISS.
So what are the implications of this? We've seen, it seems like, the space program in the United States is becoming increasingly a private sector enterprise. What are the implications of the ISS going away and NASA seeking a private sector replacement? Is this good? Is this bad? Or is the jury still out as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think you have to give NASA a lot of credit, but unfortunately they haven't been in the news as much as they probably should from all the great things like you opened up with the Apollo program, with Apollo 11's anniversary, hard to believe, what, 52 years ago. But let's highlight a little bit of what NASA's trying to do. A lot of people don't really know this, and this is quite interesting. Their project to go to the moon is known as Artemis. And what they're looking to do, they have on the design, they're going to be testing this, another incredibly powerful rocket, probably as tall as the Saturn V was in its day, some 365 feet in that kind of category, a monster rocket. Of course, Elon Musk is going to do more with his heavy lift, have heavy rockets that he's sending up. But what's interesting, if you look at NASA's program, they're going to look at building a space station. How about this? A lunar space station, Frank, around the moon called Gateway. And why is this important? Because remember the days, of course, and you know, I'm old enough, maybe the listeners, of course, actually participated in watching many of these moon missions that went to the surface. The astronauts were at grave danger if something would have happened. Look at Apollo 13. So now what we're saying is not only do we want to go back to the moon with advanced lunar modules and maybe lunar, you know, surface moving craft on the surface, you know, craft that can move around and drive on the surface like the old Apollo rovers, they're going to have something in lunar orbit. So if there's any need to go back in a safe zone, they're going to have something there. But it's also interesting that the Artemis project calls for America to send its first female astronauts to the moon. And there's a couple, there's like nine women that may be first on the moon. And this is all supposed to take place. I know it sounds a little bit early for many believe that, you know, where do we get the money for this with all the projects that the government now is trying to do? Infrastructure, you know, we're basically, what, bankrupt in many ways, ask the average person on the street.
Sure.
And I would kind of agree. But the thing, I think the implications are you're going to see a big space race again. You know, Bezos, of course, doing this Blue Origin is not his only project with New Shepard. He wants to build spacecraft that will go to the moon. But I think the most viable, in my opinion, of anybody that's going to do it is what's happening in Boca Chica down in southern Texas, where, of course, Elon Musk is launching the, you know, the Starliners, the spacecraft that eventually will go around the moon and maybe go on, of course, as the ultimate goal. The Starship, I should say, go all the way and land on the surface of Mars. So we have some very interesting competition coming. But to sum it up in average terms, I think we're looking, Frank, at seeing privatization is going to be the mother's blood. And just like money is the mother's blood of politics, I think it's going to go maybe even faster than a government and many governments that really can't sustain this. And a lot of the public that maybe, you know, we love space, but ask the average person on the street about this, and they're going to argue as they have, and maybe they have a good point. Maybe there should be other things that people should spend the money on. But we're here just to educate, and I love continuing on.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. You can check out some of his blog, his musings on any variety of subjects in this realm by going to ktar.com. He's got a terrific blog on there that covers a lot of subjects, for ranging to what you can see in the night sky to what they're doing in space. It's a blog that I go to and check regularly. I steal a lot of show topics from there. It's absolutely terrific.
Well, thank you.
Steve, and by the way, if people have questions, we'll do our best to take them. 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. If you have a question related to space, the space program, or astronomy, or what you can see in the night sky in the short term or in the long term. Steve, we've already mentioned Jeff Bezos a couple of times mm-hmm. now. And when you were
yes.
kind enough to come on last Thursday, we gave folks
Absolutely.
A little bit of a primer into mm-hmm. exactly what they had done on this Blue Origin 4-minute space flight. Mm-hmm. For people that have only been following this with passing interest, what exactly did Jeff Bezos do? Where did he go? How did the ship work? What were the kind of top line need to knows on what Jeff
sure.
Bezos did?
The backstory on this with Blue Origin is, of course, they've had many test flights that were successful to get the capsule itself to get up there, the New Shepard. And for those of you that didn't hear this or are interested, of course, and I know you are, the New Shepard is obviously going as the advanced version of what Alan Shepard did, the first American to go into space. And that's a good definition. And I'm sorry to be repetitive if some of the listeners heard this, but maybe somebody wasn't hearing it. And here we go. Back in 1961, America had so many test flights of their rockets, the Redstone, the little rocket. If you saw it today, you'd look and go, wow, that's a tiny little rocket compared to what we have today. But they had so many explosions, and some of those campy B science fi, you know, sci-fi movies, they usually show these rockets exploding on the launch pad. We had so many attempts to try to get rockets to work right. So the Paperclip group, as the Wernher von Braun group, the Peenemünde scientists that we either captured or brought here to the United States, they developed the V-2 rocket down in White Sands. But it was a great accomplishment to have Alan Shepard go on this little tiny capsule and do the flight that what Jeff Bezos kind of replicated. What did he do? Alan Shepard was launched. He went up into space. He went up probably, I don't have the exact mileage, but above that 50-mile mark. He didn't orbit the Earth as Yuri Gagarin did. That was an amazing feat even before John Glenn. But what Bezos did, I mean, you got to give credit to this technology. It's autonomous. So you and I, if we were asked to go, well, Frank, I'd have to maybe borrow some money from you. that would be interesting to go to space. But again, we're being ludicrous here. Imagine $28 million to go up for a 10 or 11-minute flight. But you notice they didn't have spacesuits on. This is very interesting. You know, you look at the old Apollo astronauts or even astronauts like Shepard and Glenn. They're in these very elaborate pressure suits built by people like Hamilton Standard. And they have environmental control systems. Look at the Apollo astronauts. Remember, we see Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins walking down to the little tiny SUV, the little RV that took them to the launch thing. They have these oxygen and air conditioners that they're carrying. Well, these guys on this flight, what did they do? They just walked out in these really cool-looking Star Trek kind of outfits, no pressure suits at all. You get strapped in the seat, And what was amazing, and of course I haven't seen the capsule up close, I mean, that would be an honor to see it, but they have some of the most amazing windows, large windows. You get strapped in the chair, and somebody else behind the curtain, as they say, is doing all the launch procedures, and it sounded like artificial intelligence. You know, you start it, it checks the weather, it checks the systems on the rocket, and Godspeed, like they say, ad astra, to the stars. They get launched up to, and obviously the flight that Bezos made, they say was upwards of about 66 miles higher than what Branson did, which allegedly he was probably in the low 50s. But it's still amazing, but the cost per pound, imagine what the cost per pound is to fly somebody to space.
No, I can't. I can't. You know, when I was talking to this about this flight in advance of it occurring with my sister, and I was explaining who was going to be on the flight with Jeff Bezos and the fact that they're going to have the oldest astronaut present, an 82-year-old woman who'd been training for this for a while.
Wally Funk. Right?
My sister mentioned, yeah, you know, she probably would have liked to have been in space for more than 4 minutes. And a lot of people have asked why this flight was only 4 minutes. Why couldn't they have taken a longer stroll around the suborbital area?
Well, great question, because it's still, and I hate to use the word, I don't want to, you know, convince the audience that this is experimental. I mean, there's great dangers. But its intent and purpose is just to go up for a short time, go beat that so-called line in space so you can claim astronaut status, and then give the world, who can afford to pay it, the most amazing amusement park-type ride that you can ever imagine. But the thing is, the rocket wasn't capable of pushing that particular craft higher up into space, because remember, it separates. And the booster rocket, which is, again, this is something even more amazing that people probably didn't pick up on. Just like Elon Musk, when I saw the return of the launch rocket, the booster rockets, like his Falcon 9s, and this, you know, and this obvious rocket that launched the crew on board Bezos' flight, part of the excitement to me was watching the rocket, the body, come back to Earth at great speed, stabilizing itself. And doing what, Frank? Firing a retro rocket to almost land in the center of a bullseye. Mm. But once you're released in the capsule, you've got maybe, what, 3-4 minutes of weightlessness because you're above that gravity area. And then another thing is that little capsule has to orientate itself down, and that ride must still be a pretty bad G-flight if you're not used to it coming through there, until eventually, how do we land? All American flights up till recently, and I think even, well, I shouldn't say this, I'll correct myself. American flights, we all know, return to the Earth landing in the water. Russian space flights were traditional to always land on the Earth. So now we have an American capsule coming down from great velocity, using a parachute system and little rockets to stabilize it, and going from super, you know, sonic speeds all the way down to, I think they said something like 7 or 8 miles per hour, and making a dust splotch in the desert. And then you open the door and you say, wow, that was a hell of a ride.
That is for sure. Talking with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. If you want to comment or ask Dr. Sky a question about space, 800-848-9222 is our telephone number. That's 1-800-848-WABC. I have a number of things we're going to ask Dr. Sky about as we continue this hour. But I have a question for you in the meantime, and that's, why have you not yet ordered Life Change Tea? Do you not want your life to change for the better? I mean, come on. Things could be a little bit better, can't they? Now, the first way and the best way to begin that process is through Life Change Tea. What does Life Change Tea do? It gives you a ton of energy without caffeine. It also helps get all the junk out of your body, out of your digestive tract. You can learn more by going to the website getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. You know, recently I learned the term get the tea is basically a young person's term for catching up with another person. I had no idea. The website's even more clever than I realized. But you can go to getthetea.com, order some of this Life Change Tea. It's all natural. It's completely organic, no fillers, no GMOs. And if you order some, you can use the promo code Frank and get free shipping anywhere in the United States. So getthetea.com is the website. You can go to the promo code Frank and enjoy free shipping. Now, they sell some other supplements on there as well. And whatever you order on through the other supplements is also going to include free shipping if you use the promo code Frank. That's the catch. GetTheTea.com, a great product, and promo code Frank gives you a great price. Straight ahead.
scalp and caressed your brain.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. That is Lords. Spending the hour with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. He is an expert on all things related to what's in the sky. You want to follow him and learn more about what he's doing and the subjects he's commenting on, go to ktar.com. There's some great programs on there. He also has a great blog on there as well. We'll take your questions at 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. We'll begin with Tony in Rockland County. Hello there, Tony.
Hello.
Oh, sorry. Good morning. I actually disconnected, Tony, as I was trying to put you back up as well, Dr. Sky. So, Tony, call back. So I'm sure Tony will be back in a second. But the Jeff Bezos flight and other similar Blue Origin flights that take place that we were talking about, how do these flights work without an aviator on board?
Well, that's a good question. And like I said before, it's all autonomous. And they've tested this about 15 times. So let's say in the little mission control that they have, and I don't really know where that is, Frank. I mean, I've tried to do as much investigative journalism on this other than go there. And maybe that's one day you'll get that from me. If hopefully we'll get out to the location and both at the Branson location in southern New Mexico. But this is all autonomous. So as I understand it, let's say there's a room with computers and advanced, hardware and software. You launch this particular rocket all autonomously. Everything on there, including the thrust for the rockets, is all controlled, metered and measured. It's all predicted to go to a certain height, and everything happens in accordance with what's going on. But here's one thing that I never, ever got an answer to, and I've asked a lot of people in the space industry. Just like the Apollo space capsule, I mean, there's Apollo space, the Saturn V with the Apollo astronauts. They had an escape system on the top of that if something were to have happened. Because imagine the amount of power in an explosive force if that Saturn V ever exploded on the launch pad, like the Russian N1 rocket. That's why they never went to the moon like we covered it last week. I don't know what safety systems were even on board, and I presume they had them. But there was never anything that I knew that said, well, if the launch is detected as not having enough thrust, let's say it starts at full power, and all of a sudden it starts to yaw because there's less power to some of the engines or the engines, what was the emergency escape system on there? I guess you pop the capsule off and you come down with parachutes? I don't know that.
You got me. All right, we're going to give another try to Tony in Rockland County. Sorry about that, Tony. That was on me.
Morning, Tony.
Good. I make a proposal. Hello?
Yeah, we're here. We actually just disconnected Dr. Sky now, so we're going to try and reconnect
I make a proposal.
Him.
Rachel, is it? Rachel, that you put her in a capsule and birthed on the moon, and you have the first child born on the moon. And were you surprised if you lifted the veil and it wasn't Leia?
I think you lost me on that one.
I'm sorry about that. I had to say something goofy like that.
All right.
Good night, sir.
Thank you, Tony. 800-848-WABC. Let's say hello to Joe here in New York City. Joe, what is your question for Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky? Hello there, Joe.
Now, the two gentlemen, multi-billionaires, right, who banned our President Trump, right? Now, what in percentages, what would be the percentage, right, of them getting killed while up there?
Well, it's a good question, Joe, and I really don't know the answer to that statistically. I'm not, not to be nasty here, I'm not the rocket builder, but the truth of the matter is, like I was mentioning to Frank before, I'm sure they have some safety systems on there. I'm not sure the ones that are on board the Blue Origin as in any detail, but they do have some escape systems that Branson has with the space plane that they had, and they've also had a series of incidents and one where they lost, series of fatal crash before they got to the level that they are right now. So I'm not sure what those percentages would be, but there is some safety factors built into this.
Would Bezos or Mr. Branson come down on parachutes, for example?
The Branson flight comes back as a space plane. It actually lands. It goes up into space once it's deployed. It fires its rocket. It goes up to altitude. It arcs up over the top. They call it the apogee. They get an opportunity to be weightless for a short period, a few minutes. The wing system on board the Branson space plane has to configure its wings so that it can turn back and come back as an airplane. So the Branson spacecraft comes back and lands on a runway, just like you and I would land in a commercial plane.
That's interesting.
Right. But
they don't need any specific training at all.
No, I shouldn't say that. The Branson flight, there's a program that you go through, and I'm sure they have a chief astronaut trainer. They do a program where I'm sure they take you through some elaborate, measures to make sure you're safe. And I'm sure the Bezos flight, they told people how to maybe get out of the craft if it had a problem. But finishing up, Joe, with the Bezos flight, obviously that comes down by parachute and landed on the surface of the Earth, a much different way to return from space, similar to what the Russians have done for so long.
Thank you,
wow.
Joe. Do we know, Steve, when the next one of these is? It was made clear that this was not going to be a one and done. Do we know when either the next Blue Origin or Virgin Galactic space flight is going to take place?
Again, Frank, not with any real specificity. From what I've read, I think we're looking at probably sometime in September or October, but that date could change. Because I think now what they're going to be doing is they're going to be perfecting every minor thing that they didn't think went well with that flight. But I couldn't see any measurable problems or nothing was announced. So you're probably looking at about a 3 or 4 month period before they do this. And again, the spacecraft and space plane that Richard Branson is using out of the southern New Mexico location there, I think they're going to probably be joining us, going back to space probably within the next couple of months, too, with a whole new set of people that are just itching to get up there. Because remember, Branson has been collecting down payments. And I think his flights, if you think about it, are much more economical. And I don't know if they raise the prices. I really got to dig into this. So the next time we talk, I may even get the opportunity to get out to one of the launches. And, Frank, it'd be nice to do this live on air, don't you think, of the night
absolutely.
Before? Absolutely. We could have some fun.
Do we know anything about the fella that bid $24 or $28 million to be on the Blue Origin flight, then all of a sudden said they had a scheduling conflict? I mean, that's some scheduling conflict.
That's a hell of a scheduling conflict. I don't really know much of the backstory there, but obviously the same price was paid for that precious seat. So they sent the nephew, the 18-year-old physics student from the Netherlands, who was obviously beaming from one end of his mouth to the other. I mean, wouldn't that be amazing? Imagine when we were 18 years old, if somebody said, hey, Frank, you guess where you're going to go? You're going to fill in for my seat and you're going to go up into space. I'd think, wait a second. I'm in another alternate reality, right?
No, I can imagine. I can imagine. Now, Jeff Bezos indicated that he's already sold $100 million worth of tickets. Now, how are people buying these tickets? Can you go online and buy a ticket for a future space flight right now?
I don't think you can. And let's change the subject just for a moment to make this very clear. Bezos, I don't think, has offered what Branson has offered. And if you go on to going back to Richard Branson, he decided out of the niceness of the space, the future of space travel, he has this opportunity where you can go on to his website, and that is Richard Branson for Virgin Galactic, and they're offering two seats. But what you have to do is you have to pay a small amount of money to get a number of seats, and they raise the price up. I think it could be like $1,000. You get, 1,000 tickets. But I haven't heard anything what Bezos is doing on that. But, there was a lot of controversy, and I thought it was pretty sad. I mean, I'm not a billionaire. I don't know your status, but let's say that.
A long way away from there.
Yeah, well, I'm being right, obviously, but God bless the billionaires. They've created their wealth, and they deserve to be able to do what they want with it. But there were so many nasty comments about Jeff's flight saying, I hope he doesn't come back. But I think in this case, Frank, and I think you would agree, maybe it's time we just separate whatever we think about whether the guy does things right with Amazon. And then he was held to task by saying things about, if it wasn't for all the Amazon people and all you folks out there, you made it possible. I guess it's very, you're stepping in a minefield when you go from that because of the inordinate expense right now. But kind of putting this in perspective and finality, it's that I think the Branson side of the equation is much more affordable if you think that they were charging or looking at doing $250,000. And I don't know about you, but that's still a lot of money to me personally, but it's still not $28 million.
That is for sure. You mentioned a couple of the differences in terms of pricing and in terms of the differences between the Branson flight and Virgin and the Bezos flight with Blue Origin. Are there any other key differences between what these two billionaires did and how their flights actually went into space?
Well, other than the technology to get there, like I mentioned before, the Branson flight is based on the old, in my opinion, and it's pretty simple to agree with this, the old X-15 type flight technology back in the late 1950s. Neil Armstrong, Pete Knight, you know, I've had interviews with a number of these X-15 pilots, never Neil Armstrong, though. They would go on this, they would have the small little rocket plane, the X-15, under the wing of a B-52 called the High and Mighty. And if you look at some of these movies, I think there was a movie with Charles Bronson called X-15. I've got it in my video archive where they go through this in great detail. So Branson has basically had a, you know, kind of this evolution of doing a modern version of what the old flight was with the B-52 and the X-15. Because have you seen the pictures? I'm sure you have, and I'm sure the listeners have, of this amazing craft that goes up to space that drops the actual space plane. That's a Burt Rutan or Rutan design. And remember, the Rutan family is very famous because one of the Rutans went around the world with Gina Yeager in that Voyager craft. And I remember talking to him at one of the big Reno air races. But it's so amazing, Frank, that if you look at that technology, what where Richard Branson is doing, it's really a cool technology. And to me, if I had my choice, I think I'd rather go up on the Branson flight. But that's just personal because you come back as if you're flying in an aircraft and not necessarily the, you know, the thrust of the rockets that go onto the Bezos flight with the Blue Origin and the New Shepard.
We're talking with Steve Cates. If you have a question, give us a call, 1-800-848-WABC. You alluded to some of the controversy surrounding Jeff Bezos. There have been a lot of people criticizing both of these folks, Branson and Bezos, criticizing this whole thing as being a symbol of income inequality, saying, well, maybe these guys shouldn't be spending money to go to space. Maybe they should be spending money to clean the ocean or do X, Y, Z. Understanding what you just said about these billionaires earn their money, they should be able to spend it on whatever they want. What do you make of that argument that maybe there's money better spent improving the Earth than going to space?
Well, I think that's an argument that, you know, I don't necessarily totally agree with that. I think if I was a billionaire, and I think let's give Bezos some credit too, I understand that he gives a tremendous amount of money to, quote, charities. And I guess whether that's from his heart or whether his accountant says he should do it, regardless, he's giving something back. But I think we need this, Frank. I mean, really, truly, and I don't want to get so philosophic here that, you know, maybe I go off the deep end here, but I'm a big fan like you are. Obviously, that's why we're here on the radio talking about this. But I think this is a great thing for young people to get some sort of inspiration. And let's go back to all this. What are we doing now as a country? God forbid we're going back into this next wave of COVID and we're looking at cities locking down. And I don't know about you, but that was probably one of the worst years I ever had from my own personal business. And I'm not embarrassed to admit it. And things are coming back. But don't you think, and I think you would agree, that we need some sort of a positivity thing?
Oh, absolutely.
Out there.
I was,
and this is awesome.
I was all for this. And I've been critical of Jeff Bezos myself, but I love what he's doing here. Where does space begin?
The official number as far as altitude, NASA goes with the 50-mile mark. The technicals that really go behind that say that there's a line in space called Kármán line from one of the scientists, and they claim it's 60 miles up. But let me define something here, and I think this is interesting because it maybe segues to some of the things that people can see in the sky, and I think they'll be fascinated to hear this. In our multi-layered atmosphere, Frank, we start off with the troposphere. We go from 0 to 16 kilometers above the ground. This is obviously the area in which our tallest mountains are, the weather. This is where the weather on the Earth is. When you see thunderstorms, it's in pretty much the troposphere. Take this analogy. Take an apple, and if you held it, and that's the entire Earth, the skin on the apple would be the thinness or thickness, I should say, of how much the weather system or troposphere is. Above that is something we call the stratosphere. That's 16 to 50 kilometers above the ground. That's where most airplanes fly. The ozone layer is located there. But beyond that, most people don't recognize this. There's something called the mesosphere. It's 50 to 80 kilometers above the ground. Temperatures drop tremendously because it contains little ozone and matter to absorb heat. So it's one of the coldest areas. And this is where meteors as we see in the sky. And I'd like to mention, if there's time, about this big shower that's coming
up. Yeah.
And then we have the thermosphere. And not to conduct astronomy 101 here on the show, but that's 90 to, say, 500 kilometers up. This is the hottest layer of the atmosphere. But what's so important about it is that it filters out gamma rays and X-rays from the sun. So we're blessed that we have this protective layer, which is way out there in space. And then comes the amazing thing called the exosphere, 500 to 10,000 kilometers out. This is an area where that almost has no matter, and satellites orbit in this layer. So what I'm saying is, when we go up into space, we're going up, let's say, into the mesosphere. So that's where space begins, at about 50 miles above the Earth. And think of that. If you took from where you're sitting at the 77 WABC studios in New York City and just drew a line like a ruler 50 miles out, obviously people that are living in the suburbs, they're listening to the show and all over the country. But if you took that line and went straight up in the sky, it really truly isn't that high, don't you think? I mean, it's really not that far up to get there. But to get there, it takes a lot of energy and a lot of skill. Because if you do it wrong, you either don't get there because your rocket goes off course and that's fatal, or you come back and then you start to eventually burn up because your body starts moving through because of the pull of the Earth. But things like the space station are upwards of about, say, 265 miles, which is still considered to be low Earth orbit. And if you ask the experts on this, how much space junk is really there, you'd be surprised at this answer. The European Space Agency, Frank, says that, get a look at this, there are some 29,000 pieces of something, meaning flecks of paint, parts of spacecraft that are 10 centimeters or larger. Here comes the next crazy number. There's 670,000 pieces of junk or whatever in space that are one centimeter or larger. And then here comes the dangerous one. There's 170 million pieces of space debris that are at least a millimeter in size. And if you remember the George Clooney Gravity movie,
sure.
If you remember the part where that debris from an exploded spacecraft, it's like getting hit by a shotgun blast at 17,000 miles an hour. So even that area above where Bezos went, I mean, that area is pretty, you know, there's not much up there at all. That's an interesting story unto itself. So there's a lot of junk up there and a lot of good spacecraft, but it's getting way too crowded in many people's opinions.
Let's say hello to Joe in Jamaica. Joe, you are on with Dr. Sky.
Good morning,
Joe. Good evening, gentlemen. Good evening.
Thank you.
Having read, you know, what the FAA said and so forth about astronauts, I have a quick question. Suppose Bezos and Delta and Branson teamed up to make a spacecraft that they could, you know, work with. What would it look like? What would it do?
That's a good question, because I think they'd be pulling in two different directions, because they're two different types, Joe. You know, one is a space plane that you just blast a big rocket, like you go up and imagine that ride. You just go up at a steep angle. But the one that they're talking about with Bezos that we're talking about is literally a rocket that goes straight up. I don't know about that. I mean, combining the two, I think, would be a little bit counterintuitive, because both of them have kind of a different way to get to space. But again, I'm a big fan of these space planes. And I think, you know, if I had a vote, I think Bezos is doing something cool. But I think it's, to me, more of an exciting thing to be able to launch after you're dropped from an airplane, and then you go up to space, and then come back and land as if you went on a regular commercial airliner.
The one thing...
On a related note, how come the U.S. doesn't continue with the shuttle?
Well, here's the answer. It was a funding thing. And I remember being down, Joe and Frank, down in Florida at the Kennedy Space Center for the very last launch of the space shuttle. And I never saw a space shuttle launch before, but why I'm telling you that is that it was so incredible, but so expensive. And through all the hardship and the loss of life that they had, overall, the space shuttle did an amazing thing. But we recognized that the technology there is all it was, is a big glider, and it did amazing things. But now what we're looking to do is get away from having those big rockets that we had on there, on the shuttle. And we're looking to go and have aircraft or spacecraft that actually can go from the ground. And guys, I think, I can't prove this, but I think if you watch Tom Cruise's new movie that's coming out with Top Gun, there's a special rocket plane that they call Dark Star in there. What am I alluding to? Mm-hmm. I think the future, and I think we already have it. I think that's why they got rid of the SR-71. They shouldn't have. I think we have some secret craft that can go from the ground, guys, launch itself like a regular aircraft would go, and go to space and return. And I'm excited to try to prove that, because I think the technology is there. And maybe that's the answer, Joe. Maybe we get something like that that goes right from the ground. You get in and you go.
Thank you, Joe. You know, one of the people that we have not touched upon so far is Elon Musk and his SpaceX program. What's happening with that? What is the latest with that as far as you're aware?
Well, his whole Starship program, I think, is really cool. Because down in Boca Chica, way down there in southern Texas, his big problem over the last year has been to try to get this particular beautiful 1950s sci-fi looking rocket to be able to launch. They went up to about 50,000 feet, 60,000 feet. And to the eyes of the world, what did we see? He went up. They had to get FAA approval on this, of course. They launched and they tried to turn this rocket back or around so that it would do exactly what his Falcon 9 boosters did, and that is come down and soft land right in the center of the bullseye. He's finally perfected that. But hopefully once that gets going, I think that's going to take leaps and bounds. And you're right, we haven't talked about Musk. And I think without a doubt, you know, I'll give him I'll tip my hat to him. I think that's still the most advanced genius of rocket technology that we've seen since the days of Wernher von Braun. And it's amazing to see what he's going to be doing, because get set, there's going to be a gigantic, super big booster rocket that's going to be launching, and they're going to put that prototype, that Starship, up on the top, the Starship itself. That's the way we're going to get up to the moon. That's the way we're going to get to Mars. And I believe, seriously, Frank, he's serious as a heart attack of doing this, and I think he'll succeed.
We've been hearing, speaking of the moon, we've been hearing a lot about something called moon wobble. Which is something that we've been warned could actually cause a dramatic increase in coastal flooding here on Earth. What exactly is moon wobble, and how will that contribute
to
coastal flooding?
Well, let me jump on this one. It's the same complaint that I have, and every once in a while I have complaints like a human being too, and here it is. In the world of journalism, I wonder sometimes why every week we get to hear huge asteroid headed toward the Earth. Right. And it comes to us, in my opinion, doing this in journalism, I don't know your opinion and the listeners, it comes to me as almost like a scare thing, because it's like, well, this asteroid's going to come close, you know, boo, it's the size of a giant Eiffel Tower or the size of a Empire State Building, but oh no, it's not going to hit us. But here we go with the moon wobble. This is another thing that I think is taken out of context. The moon wobble has been known since 1728. And what it is, it's actually called precession, or something even more technical, called a libration. And I watch the moon, like many people, with the telescope, and every once in a while you can see around the edges of the moon, because the moon is doing this wobble back in the sky over the course of a month. But Frank, the simple answer about the moon wobble is that it has an 18.6-year precession in which it moves around in the sky, and the reason people are hearing that this moon wobble could affect the tides is now this time in history, it'll change again. We're on the amplified side of the wobble. So with any of this rising of the sea naturally or not naturally because of, you know, climate change or whatever people want to believe, it will add maybe a couple of inches, maybe to a couple of feet in the future. If the continuance of the climate change goes and the seas start to rise, you could see some theoretical, coastal flooding. But they're not saying that this will take effect really until the 2030s. So if you live right near the ocean, you're probably already aware that we have this particular thing called nuisance floods, in which we get all throughout the year where we get above normal tides, and that we get every day, we get a spring tide twice a day because of the sun and the moon's alignment. So I think simply in perspective, this moon wobble has been known for such a long time, but in many articles I've read, I don't know, did you read the same, did you get the same inflection?
Yeah.
It's like, hey, the flood is coming and you better move to high.
Yeah, get on your ark. Hopefully you have two animals, grab on your ark.
Right.
800-848-9222. Ted is in Forest Hills. Ted, what's your question for Steve Cates?
No, thank you very much. I always appreciate when the doctor's on.
Thank you, sir.
I'm concerned about the James Webb telescope. It's been stalled for quite a while. Do you think it will go up soon?
I hope so. And thank you for the call, Joe. This is the perspective and the latest information that I have. Obviously, it's got a 21-foot mirror in it. And I know that the model traveled around the country and people looked at it. I didn't see it, but I saw pictures. It's this monstrous thing. It makes the Hubble look like it's a tiny little telescope. That has a 94-inch mirror. But here's the issue. It's hard to get that spacecraft to fold up like a transformer for a rocket that can actually send it to space. And they're going to do this in French Guiana aboard a French Ariane rocket. And it's scheduled to go up, and this latest I heard, at the end of October. I think it's actually on Halloween. How about that? And that will not be a spacecraft that orbits as low as the Hubble. This is going to be way out there in space. But just think about this, a 21-foot mirror.
The Lagrange point, yeah.
That's right, absolutely. The Lagrange point where it's now going to have what we call this basic, for the lack of technical information, it'll be at this fixed point where it'll be up there and it can do its thing in space far away from the Earth, far away from the light and energy and radio interference. And it'll be quite interesting, but the backstory of it is, and this is kind of spooky, is that there was an alert put out there because it has to be shipped down there to South America. And they were saying, I'm not trying to give anybody ideas, that there was a high percentage of piracy on the seas. Could you imagine somebody capturing that and holding it ransom? That's not a good story to be reading in your favorite internet news or whatever kind of newspaper you might read.
All right, 800-848-9.
Thanks, take care. God bless.
Thank you, Ted.
Thank you, Ted. 800-848-9222. Let me ask you about, speaking of the moon, this full buck moon that we saw on Friday, last Friday. It looked big. It looked red. Why was it such an unusual sight?
Well, we had a few of these so-called supermoons, Frank, in the early part of the year. This wasn't one. But the most amazing fact is when you get the moon coming to full phase, at or around the time within, say, hours of when the moon is at a position called perigee, or the closest it is to the Earth for that month, earlier in the year, we had what we call a supermoon. And by the way, a supermoon is not an astronomy term. It's actually an astrological term. But for the lack of a long description, it's the alignment of the perigee and the full moon timing. But this one, even though it's beautiful, don't all full moons look beautiful when they're rising? Because obviously the atmospherics appear to make it look larger than it really is. That's an illusion, by the way. I know that's hard to believe. But this buck moon is quite fascinating. But as we move into next year, we're going to have another series of these so-called supermoons that are actually closer. And I know we have a couple that are coming up in the next few years that are like almost record-breaking close moons. Nothing to be alarmed about, but just something to take in and, as they say, absorb the beauty and suck it in because it's an amazing thing.
Oh, that is absolutely for sure. You alluded to the meteor shower earlier.
Yes.
You wrote on your blog, which people can read at ktar.com, that this could be the creme de la creme of meteor showers. This might be the best meteor shower we see for quite some time. When is this meteor shower? How can people view it? And what makes this one so special?
Very good questions. It's the Perseids, and it's actually starting now, but unfortunately the moon is still bright in the sky. Where to look in the northeast sky after midnight? Best time, starting on the night of August the 8th when the moon is new. The moon will be out of the sky. You won't have to worry about that. Whatever you can do within the most powerful city in America, getting away from as much lights as you can, that's the task. But it all comes from, Frank, a comet we call Comet Swift-Tuttle. And it was discovered by two gentlemen, the name Swift and the name Tuttle, last names. Back on July 16, 1862, and July the 19th of 1862, this is an amazing object that spews out lots of meteors. So with the darker skies, with no moon, and the proximity of seeing this particular shower as the orbit of this comet intersects the Earth, here it is. Look to the northeast sky anytime after midnight into dawn, the best meteor shower you'll probably see of the whole year. But on an amazing end story on this, the nucleus of this comet is 16 miles allegedly in diameter. Now, that may not seem big to people, but that's large for a comet. And this comet, of all objects, this is, I didn't make this up, it's, quote, and I quote, the most dangerous object known to humanity. What does that mean? It means that all throughout history, the repetition of the nucleus coming near the Earth, it comes within a very close proximity to the Earth. And astronomers have said, and I don't want to be bad internet journalism, like I said with some of those, you know, asteroid information, blogs and such, but that this particular object probably won't hit the Earth anytime soon. It'll be very bright, and I know we won't be here to see it, in the year 2126, and it will get within a million miles of the Earth in the year 3044 AD. So all the listeners out there, after they listen to your show in its finality this morning, they can put their head to the pillow and feel rest assured that there's probably not much to worry about other than take a look at it, because the debris you see is indeed this particular material that comes off the nucleus. And in the orbit, there's tiny little flecks, maybe the size of beach sand, up to little gravel size, and maybe more. And I've watched it for 40-some years, and I can tell you, it really can produce some interesting displays.
We've been hearing a lot about this NASA Perseverance rover that's on Mars.
Yes.
What is this Perseverance rover, and what's the big deal with this guy?
Well, perseverance is something interesting. Look at the technology. As I mentioned before, it's like landing on the surface of Mars, like you're shooting a bullet from New York and hitting a bullseye to land in or hit the target in Los Angeles. Perseverance has done amazing things. It got there. It's a very complicated series, as we've talked about in the past, of how you descend those 7 to 10 minutes of hell, as they say, going through the Martian atmosphere. The same problem when people come back from space. It's dangerous if you don't have the right equipment. Kudos to NASA. They soft-landed on the surface. The object has been doing many, many explorations and running around. They call them sols, S-O-Ls, not days on the surface of Mars, because Mars's day is about 37 minutes longer than the Earth day. And out of it, even more incredible, comes this little foldable type of little drone, which is called Ingenuity, and it's been doing flawless flights. I think they've gotten it up to a mile away from the mothership. And that alone is just incredible at an object right now that's about 240 million miles away from the Earth. The Chinese have done the same thing. Again, they're the only nation in the world that's to date has not only done an orbiter, a lander, and a rover all in one shebang. We took a long time to do this ourselves, but to all the scientists out there that are doing this, Frank, that's amazing stuff. We live in amazing times. I feel so great for the young children that have the chance to study this, do STEM and STEAM programs. The future looks bright, and of course we want to be optimistic in times when there's so many reasons that people could go off the track and think of negativity.
The voice you've been hearing has been Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. He is a veteran radio and television broadcaster, and they call him an edutainer, and he is someone with a great deal of expertise in astronomy and space. If you want to hear more of him, you can go to ktar.com. That's ktar.com. We also learned, Steve, recently about this, that Blue Origin wants to build this human lunar lander on the moon at the price of about $2 billion. They've apparently offered NASA this $2 billion. Usually, a lot of other folks have said this generally goes through a standard RFP process. What Blue Origin is doing with this this lunar lander, is that different from how space usually works when it comes to private-public partnerships?
Oh, no, and you got to look at it this way. God bless the people who work at NASA. They're trying to get their project going. It's a government project. But when you have people come in, like we were mentioning Bezos and Branson, and you have, of course, Musk coming in there, this is a different kind of challenge. So I know there's a little bit of infighting and there's a little bit of politics here, but, you know, let's not go with the lowest bidder always. And I think in this case, we probably are going to see some amazing designs. Imagine that flight going to the moon. Not only will men and women walk the surface of the moon, it'll become regular and commonplace probably within the next 50 years. And you know what I would love to do? I would love, I don't know about you, and I think you'd agree, I would love to go right back to the Apollo 11 landing site and put to rest any concerns that anybody ever had about the fact that we faked the landings on the moon. I don't believe it was a Capricorn 1 movie like they would see the movie. I don't think that at all. I mean, I've talked to these people. I haven't been there. Could it be possible that I've been lied to or we've all been lied to? I don't think so, Frank. What do you think? I think we were there, and I'd love to just see the lunar landing of Apollo 11 and the spacecraft here in Arizona, the LRO, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. Check that out, folks. Go to Arizona State University's LRO webpage, and they already have images from low lunar orbit where this little thing about the size of a refrigerator has been going around the moon imaging it. They have the descent module. They have the footprints. They have the lunar rover tracks of the Apollo astronauts and the tracks that they made. I don't know. I don't think that's Photoshop, do you?
You know, I'm a guy that loves to indulge in and even sometimes encourage conspiracy theories late at night on the radio, but that's one that I find even a little too incredulous, even for me. Steve, as is always the case whenever we speak, we are just about out of time. I very much appreciate you being so generous with your time, and I'm very much looking forward to our next conversation.
I look forward to it. I thank you, and good morning to all the listeners of 77W. ABC. Thank you, Frank.
Absolutely. The great Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. Check him out on ktar.com, a man who I believe may have the best voice in radio, and we're lucky to have him contribute to this show from time to time and on the Cats Roundtable from time to time. What an intellect and what a voice. All right. We are just getting started. Coming up in about a half hour, we're going to talk with somebody who's an expert in shadow people. Now, I didn't even know what shadow people was before I started doing research on them. But it's pretty fascinating. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, though, fascinating discussion I heard yesterday about non-disclosure agreements. If you're involved in a non-disclosure agreement, should that be for life or should you get to break it? We'll explore it. Until then, keep asking questions.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Everybody, this is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. So I was listening, my co-host in the WABC Early News, Juliet Huddy, did an interview on Megyn Kelly's podcast this week. So yesterday, as I was preparing for the show and answering some emails and doing some computer work, I said, well, why don't I give it a listen? The two of them had a great discussion, and it was very nice of Juliet to mention me. I appreciate that. But they got into a discussion all about non-disclosure agreements, because apparently Andrea Macris, who had been the first prominent Bill O'Reilly accuser, is now speaking out in violation of her non-disclosure agreement. And I want to have a discussion about the role of NDAs, because this came up in the presidential race, because there were a whole bunch of women that had sued Mike Bloomberg for sexual harassment. And I think he settled with just about all of them. And they were usually women that worked for his company. And they all had to sign non-disclosure agreements. And there was a lot of pressure on Bloomberg to release these women from their non-disclosure agreements. And I think ultimately he released most of them from their non-disclosure agreements. I don't remember all the details. And as the two of them were talking, I'm thinking, if you sign a non-disclosure agreement, should you – well, let me take a step back. Should non-disclosure agreements – even be legal? So non-disclosure agreements, or NDAs for short, they are provisions that are often included in settlement agreements that prohibit people that are, in some cases, victims of sexual harassment or assault, or it could be nothing to do with anything sexual. It could be you sign a non-disclosure agreement because you're a consultant on a project or something like that. They prohibit you from publicly discussing both the settlement and what happened to you. Now, Juliet has been very public about her issues with another on-air personality. And a lot of people that sign these non-disclosure agreements fear legal liability if they violate the terms of the agreements. So obviously, sometimes the NDA can protect the victim as well, man or woman. I don't want to say just woman, because a lot of times a man won't want to, or a woman, any victim of sexual harassment won't want to keep going all over town telling their story. Sometimes it's a protection for them as well. And if they apply for a new job, I think that maybe they don't want to necessarily rehash the details of everything that happened. But the strict NDAs that were apparently used by Harvey Weinstein evidently enabled him to repeat the same patterns of harassment and assault for decades by silencing survivors from warning others about his behavior. And I think the same thing can be said of some of Michael Jackson's accusers. Remember, Michael Jackson was accused multiple times of molesting young boys. And several of these young boys got generous settlements from Michael Jackson, and they and their family had to sign a non-disclosure agreement. So I'm curious. I'd love to hear from you at 1-800-848-9222. And I don't want to mention the specifics of anyone that's on this station, because the only thing that will do will get me in trouble. So let's avoid anybody that's currently on WABC. But I'd like to talk about the issue of NDAs more generally. Should NDAs be legal? And should you be able to, if you sign an NDA, should there be any circumstance in which you get to break your silence? And if so, if your answer to that is yes, what should that circumstance be? Those are the questions I'm asking. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. And I have to tell you, originally, when I read about Andrea Macris wanting to come forward and tell her story, and when I read about the Michael Bloomberg situation, my initial reaction was, no, of course. You sign a legal document that prohibits you from speaking out about something. Well, you better not speak out about it. My friend Sam Nunberg, for instance, when he was fired from the Trump campaign, he had to sign a non-disclosure agreement, and he couldn't. Trump was very big with these NDAs, and he was not allowed to speak about his firing from the Trump campaign or speak about his time with the Trump campaign at all. Since then, I think he has violated it because he's spoken out a number of times. I don't know what his specific legal circumstances are. I know Sam's a lawyer and so are his parents, so I'm sure they dotted every I and crossed every T. But I do wonder, legally, well, ethically, are NDAs appropriate? 1-800-848-9222. Let's take Harvey Weinstein, for instance. Harvey Weinstein would pay off a woman, and that woman, as part of what she's required to do to get her payment, would have to sign this non-disclosure agreement. Now, that then enables Weinstein to engage in the same pattern of behavior with somebody else. If the first Weinstein victim, or the second, or the third, had been able to speak out, would they have saved the fourth from being victimized? 800-848-WABC. So I am sort of two minds about this, and I've been thinking about it a good portion of yesterday afternoon and evening, because I don't know how I come down on this. I don't know how you balance. Let's say you're looking to hire someone, right? And that person has been accused multiple times of sexual harassment, but all of his purported victims, or, by the way, there are female sexual harassers as well, all of that person's purported victims are not able to speak out about it because of a non-disclosure agreement. Well, do you think an employer might be less likely to hire someone if they knew that that person had all these allegations of sexual harassment, so that it was a pattern? And it doesn't even have to be sexual harassment. It could be being disruptive in the workplace or any number of other things that might make a prospective employer bristle. But with those non-disclosure agreements in place, those employers are never going to know about that. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. I also see the other side, where if you're wrongly accused of sexual harassment, and you, let's say your company has an insurance policy, and you're able to pay off one of these accusers just to make the case go away, and that person would have to sign an NDA, not repeating their false allegation, and you avoid years in court and years worth of legal fees, then I think that the NDA serves a pretty important purpose. What do you think? 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Because this debate, the Weinstein situation and all these other folks, has caused a reexamination of whether NDAs are enforceable and what recourse survivors might have if they do want to break their silence. So I'm curious what you think about this. 800-848-9222. There are certain state laws that prohibit NDAs in certain sexual misconduct cases. California, for instance, they have a law that bars settlement agreements that contain non-disclosure provisions. So where do you come down on all this? 800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Cam in Spokane, Washington. Hello, Cam.
Hey, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well. How are you listening to us in Spokane? Are you on the internet or on the radio? Well,
I'm on the radio talking through my car, okay, so.
Well, that's pretty impressive that you hear us all the way out in Washington.
Well, I'm heading to Walla Walla, Washington, where they have a lot of institutions where they take care of old people. I deliver pharmacy.
Wonderful. All right. Well, so what's your opinion on what we're talking about, these NDAs?
Well, you're right. You're right. You know, there are two minds about that because, I mean, you know, it could protect the victim, but then it could protect the perpetrator also, you know, in case these people want to come back on them, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So what do we do? What do we do in terms of policing these non-disclosure agreements going forward?
Well, you know, I really don't agree with them having to sign a non-disclosure agreement, number one, because, I mean, you know, these guys are getting away with shit, you know, or excuse my language.
Yeah, you can't say that.
And then, I'm sorry, but we talked that way up here. Anyway, so, and then, but then again, I mean, you know, you've got to, you know, the actual victim probably had a hand in it anyway, you know.
Well, I mean, we don't know. I mean, there are some, and thanks for the call, Cam. I think that's becomes very dangerous once you start victim shaming. The so-called victim probably had a hand in it anyway. Look, there are some sexual harassment cases which are demonstrably false, right? I was once accused of sexual harassment. In fact, both my brothers in different circumstances were also accused of sexual harassment. Say what you want about the three of us. None of the three of us are sexual harassers. So my brother's now a doctor, right? Should this false – not a doctor, but, you know, a PhD. Should this false allegation of sexual harassment follow him around for his whole career? I don't think so, right? Same with me, right? So if there was a circumstance where in order to make this go away, if there were a false claim, why shouldn't the purported victim that's getting a settlement as a provision of getting that money – have to sign a non-disclosure agreement? So I have been wrestling with this the whole day, and I'm wondering if there is some sort of compromise here. And if there is, I'd love to try and figure out what it is. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Miles is in New Jersey. Hello, Miles.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
So my opinion is, you know, in order to have a valid NDA, you have to have consideration, which means that both parties get something. So one party gets a large settlement amount. The other party gets the ability for the person who signed it not to speak about what happened. So that is very, very common. And NDAs serve a very useful purpose. If not, then cases would go to court and you would have a long, protracted battle. So they serve a very useful purpose.
Now, I agree with everything you said there, Miles, and that's generally been my view when this debate has come up previously. But what do you say to a situation where you have somebody that is, let's say, a serial sexual harasser, and if their victims had been able to speak out about that pattern of sexual harassment, that would have saved the next woman or man, for that matter, because we've seen plenty of men be sexually assaulted and harassed as well. That would have saved the next victim from being harassed or assaulted.
Right. But you can't have it both ways. You can't take a large settlement amount
right.
and then have the ability to speak about it. So they have to make that moral decision to say, you know what? This person committed a crime against me. I'm not going to take that settlement amount. I'm going to go to the police and I'm going to talk about it. So it's really incumbent upon them to do what they think is right, but they can't have it both ways.
Well, well said, Miles. Now, you're an attorney yourself, right?
Yes, correct.
And what kind of law do you practice?
Corporate.
Corporate. Do you come across a lot of NDAs in the corporate world as well?
All the time. All the time. You know why? Because people are very proprietary about their business. It could be trade secrets. It could be anything. But the most important thing about an NDA, there's also non-disparagement, which means that both parties cannot say anything defamatory about the other party. So it's a way to settle an event. And it's so costly to go to court these days that the NDA provides a mechanism that both sides gets what they want very efficiently.
I read, not in terms of any of these sexual harassment NDAs, but in terms of your field, corporate NDAs, that some of these NDAs are so broad in terms of what you're not allowed to speak about that. In fact, I read one article in the Harvard Business Review on this subject that they say that NDAs could chill competition through these expansive definitions of what must remain confidential and proprietary, and therefore reduce the ability of a discontent employee or an employee working in a hostile work environment to go elsewhere. What do you say to that argument?
Well, that's exactly what it's for, because if I am hiring somebody, I'm paying them, I'm giving them everything necessary to do their work. Whatever they produce is mine. It doesn't belong to them. And that's just the way it is. And that's what people have to recognize. But the one thing I always say when I'm writing an NDA to the other party is make sure you have an attorney look at it, because you can negotiate these NDAs to make sure that your rights are protected. So this whole thing about NDAs being terrible things, no, they provide a very useful mechanism.
Yeah, and thank you for the call, Miles. Very well thought out and very thorough. I want to be very clear. I'm not saying NDAs are terrible things. I'm saying are NDAs sometimes overly broad to chill competition in the private sector workplace? And can the enforcement of NDAs cause some people to be victimized by predators who would not have otherwise been in a position to victimize them? 800-848-WABC. Marvin is here in Manhattan. Hello, Marvin.
I want to say something. When you sign disagreement, you automatically become victimized because it is an admission of guilt, and you can later on be fired from your job because you now have bullseye on your back.
Well, that's a good point, Marvin. Thank you. 800-848-WABC. Steve on the Lower East Side, what's your view?
Hey, Frank. Well, there again, you know, it's a double-edged sword. Fortunately, like in cases with Harvey and Michael Jackson, it does protect them, okay? But there again, no one puts a gun to your head to sign that agreement, right or wrong. So,
right, but I agree with you. And of course, you're right. But let's say you're in a situation where your lawyers are saying to you, look, you know, if you want your life back, if you don't want to go through years of litigation, if you don't want to also be countersued by this wealthy, powerful guy that you're going after, take this money and move on with your life. You're not going to get another job in whatever field you're in. Everyone thinks you're risky, a risky person now. So take this money and move on. And the only way you're getting this money is if you sign a non-disclosure agreement. You're right, but sometimes there can seem like there's a lot of pressure in that circumstance. You see what I'm saying, Steve?
Oh, no, well, absolutely, Frank. I mean, you're like in a rock and a hard place. And I can understand, well, also on the other side of the coin, even like, okay, perfect example, like Donald Trump, even if you're a successful businessman, and even if you are innocent of the allegations, like you said, you don't want the media dragging that truth, that, you know, scandals and stories, because that can hurt company stock. It can affect you and your business in so many different ways. So a non-disclosure agreement there, of course, is, I guess, a tool or a way to go, because, like, if again, you know, you're signing an agreement that you cannot speak of this incident, and if you do, there will be legal repercussions. So it's a difficult choice, you know. What's the answer? You know what?
Well, and look, Frank, and thank you for the call, Steve. I was just researching, since you mentioned Trump, some of the Trump non-disclosure agreements, because as I said, Trump was very big on these NDAs in the political world and in the business world. And I was just reading this article from Politico. This is from March, where a court, a federal court, actually voided the Trump campaign's non-disclosure agreement with a former campaign worker, the former Hispanic outreach director. They said, the court said that it was too broad and vague to enforce. So I guess a court does have the latitude, as they did with this Trump NDA, a court does have the latitude to say, well, wait a minute, you can't enforce that NDA. It's too vague. But then I wonder, what does that mean if you're signing the NDA? Does in this case, does the Trump campaign have no protection? I guess not. Then why did they give this person a severance if they were going to have no protection from being disparaged? It's not an easy situation. And I know there are much brighter legal minds and ethical minds than me trying to figure this out and trying to hash this out. And we're not going to come to a solution in the next 10 minutes or so. But I do think I was curious to get your perspective on it. 800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Mr. Kaya in Manhattan. Hello, Mr. Kaya.
Hi, how are you tonight? I live in a world of NDAs, work for hires, RFTs. Basically, they're about intellectual property and trade secrets. Criminal acts, really, you're not going to be able to protect that. And the other thing to keep in mind is when something becomes public, if someone else squeals, then you can speak up.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and also they're very hard to enforce. It's hard to prove damages, like with intellectual property. If I showed you a new cartoon, and then you ran out and you stole it, and you made a movie about it first, the NDA would protect me.
Interesting.
Hopefully.
Interesting. That's interesting.
As far as criminal acts, I'm sure some lawyer would try to misuse it. And you're correct. You know, if they're too broad, like in the Trump case, they're going to get dumped. They're really not all that scary. And a lot of them have time limits, too.
Oh, they all have time limits?
They're effective for 3 years.
Well, so in the case of, and again, I don't want to focus on O'Reilly specifically because, again, it's only going to get me in trouble. But in the case of Andrea Macris, she signed her NDA, I think, 17 years ago. So why is she now saying that her speaking out is violating it if they have time constraints? Maybe the time constraint expands beyond.
Like I say, most of these have time limits on them.
I see.
When you sign them, I mean, I don't have her NDA in front of me. I don't think she's in much trouble.
Gotcha. Well, it's going to be very interesting. Thank you for the call, Mr. Kaya. We'll continue with your calls in just a minute, and then we're going to talk with an expert in shadow people coming up in just a few minutes. I'm looking forward to chatting with Heidi Hollis. Stay up, don't sleep. That's Dominic Carter. Every night when I come in, says the same thing to me. Off air. He says, I got to stop listening to you, man. He says, and he's always very complimentary. He's just so encouraging and such a nice guy. But he always says, I get home, takes me about an hour to drive home, and I want to keep listening to you. And I end up staying in my car for another extra few minutes. So I know some of you out there are contemplating going to sleep. Don't do it. Stay awake, because not only are we going to talk about shadow people, but we got the AC report coming up at 3:30 with the former executive director of the CRDA. And not only is the CRDA kind of the go-to entity that makes Atlantic City run, and I've always been curious about the CRDA, and the current executive director has not accepted any of my invitations to come on this show, but not only is Thomas Carver the former executive director of the CRDA, he also happens to be the grandfather of our own Molly, our telephone talent coordinator. So I'm going to see if I can get him to tell me a few good Molly stories as well. Meantime, we're talking about non-disclosure agreements. How do you like how they're treated these days? Do you think it's appropriate that if you're a victim of, say, sexual harassment or sexual assault, that you can never speak about it? Even if you get a giant boatload of money, if you work on a project with someone at work and then you have a falling out with your boss, should this overly expansive NDA prevent you for a lifetime, essentially, from doing any work similar to that? Trying to get your take from a legal perspective, from an ethical perspective. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Pepsi in the Bronx. Is that your Christian name?
Well, I was born in the 60s, and that's the first thing that my mother asked for when I was born, so it's in there.
Love it. What's on your mind?
I could have been called Jose Cuervo or Dr. Pepper, but Pepsi's not so bad.
Not at all.
Well, this is my take on the NDAs. Excuse me. For business, you know, you want some assurances that you can discuss some intellectual material and have it, you know, be safe and not stolen from you. But as far as somebody, a rich person, using it to kind of get a mulligan on a felony, all right, that's like, you know, taking advantage of, you know, of a good thing, because I feel like if somebody does something like, let's say, the Harvey Weinstein situation, if he does it once, right, gets accused for it and has to go through all of this and makes a settlement, and, you know, the alleged victim signs the NDA, then fair enough. But then if it becomes a pattern, then it should be automatically disqualified, you know what I mean, because you can obviously see somebody's trying to use the system. You know, so it's like a two strikes or three strikes, you're out kind of situation, where if somebody's doing something felonious and, you know, they're doing it over and over again, it should just nullify the NDA so that, you know, it could be represented that this person is, you know, not a good guy.
That is interesting. So you're saying, you know, if there's a repeated pattern, well, how do you know, though? Let's say you went with this.
Well, the court system. Somebody's going to take you to court.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah. I don't know once you sign the NDA and you make a settlement, if there's like a registry of NDAs that you can somehow look up. Like, I don't know if
If the person who's accused, like, let's say, I'm just using Harvey Weinstein just because it's an
sure.
easy, you know,
yep.
situation. But let's say he does something and someone signs an NDA, right, and gets the money and everything else is fine. Then somebody else accuses him, all right, and, you know, takes him to court. The courts are going to know by his record that somebody else, you know, had signed the NDA. It would be public record.
That's what I'm saying is I'm not sure. I guess you're right. I mean, you'd see that the case was dismissed, and I guess you'd be able to infer that there was a non-disclosure agreement. Great call, Pepsi. Thank you. 800-848-WABC. I want to squeeze in one more call here before we go to Heidi Hollis. Let me say hello to Tricia in Connecticut. Hello, Tricia.
Hi, Frank. I like that last caller's comment, and I'm generally on NDAs. A contract is a contract, and when a person signs it, that's the law. But in the sexual cases, maybe there could be something in jurisdiction similar to a FISA court that's secret, confidential, not go to run to the press and say, well, he did this to me, but disclose it to the lawyers in this small group, and then it could be used if there is a pattern, so that someone doesn't, you know, similar to Catholic indulgences where you pay off money and then you repeat your sin.
Yeah. Well, and thank you for the call, Tricia. I think that's the trick, right? I mean, how do you get the press not to report on it, right? In this country with the First Amendment and with public courts, everything, or almost everything, ends up being public. So I think that might be either easier conceived than implemented. But as I said, I knew we wouldn't come up with a solution here, but it's something I want to follow up on in the future, because I think this is becoming increasingly common. 800-848-9222. Very excited to talk with Heidi Hollis in just a bit. In preparing for this interview, I learned more about shadow people, something that I'd never even heard of, than I ever dreamed of. And you're going to be pretty eager to learn what they are as well. Heidi Hollis joins me straight ahead.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Have you ever heard of shadow people? Well, Heidi Hollis has, and she's become something of an expert in it. She's written about it. She is an author, a host, a producer, a podcaster, a host of a wildly popular podcaster, and even a cartoonist. And I am just thrilled that she's agreed to stay up late with us and educate us about what shadow people are. Heidi, thanks so much for joining me on the radio.
I appreciate you reaching out. This is awesome.
Heidi, so let's begin from the beginning. Shadow people, it sounds ominous. It sounds scary. What exactly are shadow people?
Well, shadow people are, believe it or not, an entity that I discovered. I mean, I believe I'm the only person to discover, name, define, and even trademark two paranormal paranormal phenomena, shadow people and Hat Man. Which
oh, yeah.
Kind of
we're going to get to the Hat Man mm-hmm. in a second because that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
But so how did you discover shadow people and what are they?
Well, it was something that I saw following a friend of mine, and apparently it's kind of like a contagion. It started following me as well. And it's a, what it is that shadow people are these things that can shape shift to form anything from kind of something that looks like a man with its head directly connected to its shoulders, anywhere from 8 to 10 feet tall. But they could also be something as small as shadow spider looking things or streaks or clouds and, or rodents. And what they do, one of their favorite pastime things to do, unfortunately, are to prey upon the fears of others. And so a lot of people will report feeling like a pressure on their chest and being unable to wake or move fully. And sometimes when these things get really close, you'll see glowing red eyes, which just adds to the horror and the terror of their presence. And people say, you know, it's a horror like you just can't even imagine, just to see an absence of light is what it looks like to them. And they're often seen alongside of aliens, hauntings. It's such a strange phenomena. And their ultimate goal, I mean, it just seems to be to harass people. So many people, I've had thousands of people write me from around the world, and people will often describe having this knowing, like, you know, like they're so full of fear, but when they let go of the fear, like these things are feeding on it. And when they just can't give any more fear, these things give up and go. But then oftentimes they seem to be the thing that's hanging around a heavily haunted place and almost as if to hold souls in a certain location. So it's a really in-depth topic that, you know, when I first wrote the book in 1997 and finally put it out in 2001, you know, I didn't know how widespread this had already begun, but I was warned, I guess you could say, that this would become a worldwide phenomenon. And the day that I went out and started talking about it and speaking at conferences and doing what I could on my own dime as a college kid, you know, just getting out of school and just knowing how important this was, I have been slammed with thousands of emails from around the globe ever since.
So in your own case, the observation that you had of the shadow people, you said it could take other shapes and it could look like a rodent or something else. How do you know if what's following you is a shadow person?
Well, it gives off this really haunting like feeling. You feel like you're being observed, and oftentimes people will see something off their peripheral vision, and they think, you know, what if there's a giant bat moving past me? You know, but there's nothing in their home, for crying out loud. And so people get this really this certain feeling of knowing something is there, something is wrong, and it feels very negative, and it feels very watchful or nosy even. So it's different from the presence of a ghost. And, you know, when I was first introducing this topic, you know, here's two topics nobody has ever heard of. And they're like, this lady's talking, you know, science fiction, you know, and I'm like, no, this is really, really something that's a phenomena that you won't know it until you see it for yourself. And these ghost hunters would write me and say, you know, that's just a shadow of a ghost. I'm like, you just wait. And then when they would meet one of these things, they are like, oh my, you know, I take it back. This is a lot more sinister. It's weird to say that you can feel the evil in these things, but you can.
So if someone thinks they have an ominous feeling or they see something following them and they wonder what it is, to determine whether it's a shadow person, I guess the best way to do that is to determine what sort of feeling you get when you're being followed by it.
That is one of the ways. But of course, the appearance, if you catch it in your peripheral vision and you turn your head, and your periphery vision is more sensitive to the differences between light and dark. So that's why a lot of times people will catch, you know, look like something walked past them or zipped by them and not see it when they look at it head on. But sometimes these things get really angry that you spotted them and they'll charge at you. So they could be quite aggressive. So there's definitely a distinction if you feel like something paranormal is going on. Like, why am I getting this weird feeling? And why was I pinned down on my bed, unable to move? And, the whole topic of sleep paralysis got popular all of a sudden when the topic of shadow people, when I introduced it out there to the world, they're trying to explain it away. Like, well, of course, you know, it's just a natural phenomena that happens with your body at rest. And it's like your mind wakes up, but your body does not. And I'm like, nice try. Why are people all describing the same things? Which also goes into the topic of Hat Man. You know, you're going to see somebody looking like this in your room, or you're going to see glowing red-eyed creatures that are within an inch of your face and, you know, taunting you, absolutely taunting you, growling. The shadow people don't tend to talk. They can be, they can whisper things that are sometimes hard to understand, or they growl. So, yeah, you do know that you're dealing with something that is not human and not ever been human.
Wow. How many people, after you wrote your book and spoke out about this, and if people are just tuning in, we are talking with Heidi Hollis. She is an author, has written a number of books on this and other subjects. You could check out her website at HeidiHollis.com. That's HeidiHollis.com. How many people reached out to you and told you that they believed that they had encountered one of these shadow people?
Oh my gosh. The first time I hit a major radio show, I had thousands and thousands piling in. You know, back then it was AOL. And if you didn't save your emails when you open it, they deleted. So it just kept pouring in and I couldn't save them fast enough. So by that first night, I would say well over 5,000. And, you know, that was in 2002. And I've been having thousands and thousands ever since. So I've had everything from priests reaching out to me, to nuns, to superstars, to doctors, to psychiatrists, and, you know, all saying, what do I do? You know, what is going on here? And, you know, I just it's such a strange thing. You know, I have a hard time putting it out there to the world to say this is a real thing. I totally stepped aside from my career. I'm an occupational therapist where I focus on patients who have psychological and cognitive dysfunction to try to help them to become more independent. And to step aside from my career fresh out of college, knowing how important this topic was going to be to the world, and to be poo-pooed. And I'm African-American, you know, and it's like, who's this brown chick going around, coming to our conferences, you know, saying, hey, look out, this is about to be a major problem. And then to have this, you know, turn out the way that it has. And, you know, I'll tell you too, like a lot of people are like, well, why trademark it? And I trademarked both of these things more recently because I received so many emails from people saying, well, your film or your TV show, it didn't match your book. I'm like, I don't have a single TV show or film out there. Little did I know that people were grabbing my material and putting it out there to the world and causing harm. And I have children who will write me. You know, they're not always just playing games on your cell phones. I'll put it out there to you guys because they will tell me, you know, my mom thinks I'm crazy. I'm 8 years old. I'm like, what is going on here? You know, it's out of control. And the pandemic has made it worse.
I saw a video that you had done on that. I want to ask you about that. But first, I want to ask you your best guess as to what these creatures or entities are. What do you think they are?
Well, interesting enough, it's not even an opinion. It's something that I had an experience with a college roommate that it kind of explained to us what was happening, you know, because my place was just overrun with these things and we're both witnessing it. And she, who was a very, very religious person, just thought anything out of the ordinary is demonic, you know, just keep it away from me. But she had an encounter with a non-human looking thing. And it essentially, long story short, expressed to her, to myself, through her to me, saying that these things were essentially a demonic type creature and that this was not the first planet that this has happened to. And they've infiltrated and they influence. And it's kind of like, it's really not a whole lot more different than what has been expressed in a lot of different religions. You know, having something negative sitting on your shoulder, whispering in your ear, saying, do this versus that, and pulling your strings. And, you know, just it's so strange. But they possess, they oppress, and they depress people. And then possess people to do horrible things. And, if I hadn't experienced some of the stuff that I had alongside of people who could confirm, oh, my gosh, yes, I saw that, too. You know, I would have thought, like, you know, I grew up in a haunted house and I would have just, like, chalked it up to another weird experience. But, you know, there was no way to deny getting the information that I did, which is why I felt so urgent to take it upon myself to step out there to the world using my real name, because a lot of people who get into these fields don't want to be ridiculed. So they'll use their middle name or something. And I'm like, no. I got to stand by what it is that I feel to be, a very real threat to the human condition. And, lo and behold, it's been tragic. It's been tragic. And it breaks my heart. I mean, I'm one person reading all these emails, trying to respond, which is what I do on my podcast. And, I find it's easier to, I tell people to go to shadowfolks.com, and I cover so many different topics, you know, and I try to just give an honest to goodness explanation or insight about why people experience everything from angels to aliens, shadow people to Hat Man. And, you know, just to keep it on the level, because, people say, ooh, that's spooky, that's weird stuff. You know, I don't try to scare people. I want people to have a conversation about this stuff and keep it real, because I know how to clear a room when I want to, but people are more comfortable when you're yourself expressing, this is real, this is what happened to me, and I'm just going to be honest with you, as painfully honest as I can, because that's the way humans get by, being humanly flawed with a sense of humor and, you know, shed some light on this stuff.
Now, Heidi, in terms of when you see one of these, even if it's your peripheral vision or whatever, can they be photographed? Have you had any luck photographing or getting on video one of these shadow people?
Personally, I don't aim to try to, but I've had several sent to me over the years. Yes, they are seen. They've been captured quite clearly. And, absolutely horrific and just bone chilling every single time people report having caught something like that. And very, very disturbing.
So if people experience one of these things and they want to reach out to you to share their story or get advice, the best way to do that is to go to shadowpeople.com.
Shadowfolks.com.
Yes.
And again, it's all about just keeping it real, having people vent or comment or even share their own research about whatever it is that they've experienced or looked into. I mean, I'm hoping to change this pattern of, that's those weird people that talk about this. It's like, no, I mean, this is, It's a shame that I get emails from everywhere, from Japan to Australia, and they're asking me and telling me things that they can't roll over in bed and talk to their spouse about, or go to work. You know, sometimes these people fight for their lives. They feel like they've fought for their lives, have to get out of bed and pretend like nothing ever happened, and they're terrified to sleep. And they're just begging for relief. And that's another thing I try to do. And I'm not a psychic or a guru. I try to tell them how they can protect themselves, and, you know, and also give them confidence to know that these oftentimes shadow people will come at night. Not always, of course. They could come in broad daylight. That's how I first saw one. But they really love to get a person when they're down.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. That actually mm-hmm. is the subject of a question from one listener, Joe in Queens. Joe, you're mm-hmm. on with Heidi Hollis.
Yeah, Heidi. Yeah. You said they could come during the day. Would they be as blatant as mixing in with a crowd, say, at the beach? Would they be that conspicuous and that? Yeah.
Yeah, they have been, actually. People have caught them. It's not as easy always to spot these things, but they don't like that one person in the crowd who does spot them, and that's why they'll often charge that person. So not everybody is absolutely able to see them as clearly as the next. And but it should give people confidence to know when they do go at you that you're somebody special, somebody a little different. A little gifted is a word, or even creative to be able to spot them. So people think, oh my gosh, you know, I must have done something awful to have this demonic thing come at me. I'm like, no, it tells me actually the opposite usually. But there's also people who say, well, I was on drugs, I was drunk. Things like that do attract these things as well, or even being sick or mentally ill or depressed. And I mean, these things do get attracted for different reasons. And sometimes it takes, for me, when I'm interviewing the folks, to find out better what was going on in their situation, why a certain type showed up or a certain situation or experience happened.
Well, that's pretty interesting, Heidi. Now, before I let you go, and there's so many fascinating things that I could talk with you about, I hope you'll come back. I have to ask you about another subject that you've explored a great deal, the Hat Man. Who or what is the Hat Man?
The Hat Man is more than explored. I also named, defined, and discovered him as well. And he is this guy that shows up usually wearing a three-piece suit. He could have a gaucho hat to a top hat. It could be he could wear a cape to a trench coat. Sometimes people can see his skin, and if they do, his eyes are solid black. Other times, if he's like in his shadow form, they'll see his eyes are glowing red, and he likes to talk. He loves to talk. He loves to laugh. When he smiles, it's very much like the Joker that goes ear to ear, and his teeth are like Pennywise from It. I mean, just the most horrific thing that you can imagine. And people say, even if they meet him one time in their lifetime, they fear the day he ever returns. And other people have seen him nightly, and he just taunts them. And he will tell you he is the devil himself. He will tell you that.
Have you ever seen the Hat Man?
Unfortunately, yes. When I wrote my book, The Hat Man, the other book, by the way, is called The Secret War. But my second book on the Hat Man, oh my goodness, yes. I was just about to put that book out when he started to make his presence known. He went after my patient twice, 2 days in a row. He came at me in my home. And, you know, was it 2 weeks after I published my book on him, that attack with those two little girls, the 12-year-olds, the Slender Man attack in Wisconsin. So two little girls stabbed another 12-year-old girl. And they said the Slender Man wanted them to do this. Now, Slender Man is, of course, a straight take from the Hat Man phenomena that I put out there. And this took place a 15-minute drive from my family's home in Wisconsin. And I'm like, you know, he was giving me messages straight out several times just before I put that book out and then after. So I took it really personal when it happened again. And I just, with him, there's no coincidences. But Hat Man phenomena has taken over my email, my inbox. he is through the roof. And to say that the percentage of the increase is just phenomenal. And during the pandemic, it's just multiplying and multiplying. And he is so sinister. And he is the one that controls the shadow people. So they're kind of like his minions, if I could give him a title. Mm. But he also kind of rides over this other entity that's a grim reaper looking thing. There's a hooded creature with glowing red eyes that are perfectly round. There's the old hag syndrome. He's also been seen alongside of them. And then, of course, seen right alongside of aliens. So he is really versatile, disgusting, and he does the worst things. He bites, he scratches, he punches, he kicks. He takes his fist. Now, this is really a horrible thing. So when people see him, he does the whole thing with the paralysis and all this stuff, but he could be seen in broad daylight as well. But just like shadow people, they're kind of cowardice, and they come when your guard is down and you're sleeping at night. So that says something about the human potential. Like, why can't you take me on for who I am? No, they like to come like a thief in the night. And so he paralyzes people and gets within an inch of their face. And when people are just screaming, can't take it anymore, and they just give up, like, kill me already type of thing, he takes his fist and he punches it through their chest and rips their soul out and throws them to the floor. And sometimes they get away. Other times he's like dragging them laughing, like, now I have you, now you're going to work for me type of thing. But when, you know, of course, I don't hear from the people he keeps pulling wherever he's taking them, but the people that get back to their bodies, and they're like, what do I do to keep him away? And that's the important thing. You know, it's not always important to know why he's there or why shadow people come, but more how to keep them away.
We've been talking with Heidi Hollis. In the final minute that we have here, Heidi, tell me why you think we've seen such an uptick in paranormal activity of all sorts in the midst of the pandemic.
Oh, well, people are losing their jobs. They're sick. They're ill. They're dying. They're being evicted. So there's a lot of negativity out there. So this is just exploding out there to attract anything that's negative. So, yeah, I'm not surprised that anything out of the ordinary that has a bad influence is creeping around having a good time right now. And that just shows that we have to keep the faith, keep more positive, and, you know, show these things the door.
Well said. Heidi Hollis, you can check out her books. She's written about the shadow people. She's written about a number of different things. You could check out her YouTube channel. Just search Heidi Hollis. The website is HeidiHollis.com. Heidi, I hope we can chat again soon.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Thank you so much. This was great.
Thank you. You want to comment on any portion of our discussion, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Until next hour, in the words of the great Bob Barker, help control the pet population. Make sure you have your dog or cat spayed or neutered. Everybody, this is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. So my wife asked me a question yesterday, and she asked, I was talking about all the work that I put into this show and that Molly puts into this show and Rob, and, you know, it's basically just the three of us putting together this, you know, this whole show. So she asked me, don't you guys have interns that could do that? Do this or do that. And I said, no, you know, it's funny. I think unpaid internships are actually illegal, because at the last radio station I worked at, we at one time did have unpaid interns in that they could get college credit, but we were told at some point that that was no longer allowed. And I think, so I did a little research, sure enough. And I found that it's not technically illegal, even though in New York, there's a lot of pressure for companies to pay the interns minimum wage. But when it comes to media companies especially, there have been so many lawsuits that found that the interns were, for lack of a better description, slave labor. The interns were doing work but not getting paid, and that's not allowed. Sirius XM Radio, for instance, 6 years ago, and there was a bunch of these. I'm not limiting it to just Sirius. There was there's a dozen different cases I found just in 10 minutes of Googling before the show. Sirius XM Radio agreed to pay up to $1.3 million to settle claims that it violated U.S. labor laws by not paying interns, making the satellite radio provider the latest large company, at least in 2015, to settle such a case. So you had a case where the plaintiffs worked on the Howard Stern show and other Sirius projects. They claim they worked up to 40 hours per week and were not paid. And that was a violation of the Fair Labor Standard Act and New York's minimum wage law. So this settlement by Sirius, which was then approved by a judge, basically agreed, was their way of making this case go away. The primary test by the courts in such cases is whether internships were designed primarily to educate young people in a particular field as opposed to companies using unpaid workers for the same tasks performed by regular employees. So that's why we're seeing interns used more sparingly. Because if you have an intern and you don't pay them, the test that the courts have established is that they have to be there primarily to learn, not to be a gopher, not to be somebody's assistant that you don't have to pay, not to do work that the other paid employees don't have time to do. Otherwise, you have to pay them or you get in trouble. So that's kind of the current test. Lo and behold, this year, there have been a plethora of opinion pieces from very respectable publications calling for a complete ban on unpaid internships. Brandon Busteed, for instance, wrote in Forbes.com that it's time for unpaid internships to come to an end. There was there's a website called The Conversation, and there was an article which said COVID-19, this was just from February, COVID-19 shows why it's time to finally end unpaid college internships. So unpaid internships are often seen, as the article writes, as an important rite of passage for college students. And the authors of this article, I always like to give credit, Matthew Hora, who's an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin, and Mindy Thompson, who's a professor of counseling psychology at the University of Wisconsin. And studies have found that students acquire new skills and networks that enhance their job prospects. And the years just after graduating from college, students who have an internship are 15% less likely to be unemployed and earn 6% more than students who didn't. But as the authors of this piece write, however, as researchers who study how students transition from college and into the workforce, we note that it is clear that asking college students to work for free is problematic. We believe the value of unpaid internships is even more questionable due to the economic challenges associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. Besides the legal and ethical questions of not paying people for their work, unpaid internships also favor students from affluent families. Now, that's true. I wouldn't say my family was rich, but I would say we were certainly middle class, maybe even upper middle class. And I was able to do several internships when I was in college, and I think maybe even after college, right? No, it was just while I was in college. I interned here at this radio station. I interned for the Brooklyn Cyclones. I interned for the Fox News Channel. I might have interned one or two other places. So I was talking with my wife. Now, my wife is one of nine. Now, when you have nine kids in a family, it's very tough to pay the bills. So she was saying that she never had an internship. My wife is a journalist. She never had an internship anywhere because she couldn't afford to use that time working for free. She always had to. She always had to get paid to work to pay her bills. And that was a luxury that I had that she did not. The only internship she had was after she graduated. And I'm not sure if it was a paid internship or not. She didn't specify in our conversation about this. But I really do, even with the economic disincentive to participate for lower income families, I really do think there is a tremendous value to unpaid internships, particularly when they're being done for college credit. I'll say only when they're being done for college credit, because if you're going to have interns just come in and work for free and they're not even getting college credit, then, I mean, that's blatantly just slavery. But I think there's enormous educational value to preserving these unpaid college internships. I can tell you about radio and about television, I learned far more interning than I ever did in a classroom. The network of people that I met while interning in various places is a group of people, many of whom are still very important business and professional contacts to this day. So I find the value of an unpaid internship enormous. Now, what do you do about someone's family who just can't afford to have their kid do an unpaid internship? Do you shrug your shoulders and say, well, you know, tough? I don't think so. And I think maybe there's a way to keep these unpaid internships, which to me are keeping in the tradition of what we've always seen. Apprentices, going back to the Middle Ages, going back to the feudalism. Apprentices in different fields who train and work for a professional in whatever field they're studying to learn in, and then until they can develop enough of the craft themselves to engage in that. So I'm wondering if there's something that can be done for teenagers, college students primarily, who don't have the same advantages as other kids, but at the same time would get a lot of value out of interning at a place. So these writers who are advocating for ending unpaid college internships cite the class divide and how the legal scholar Jessica Curiel, unpaid internships effectively enhanced this class divide. The divide is due to the fact that low and middle income students can't afford, for the reasons that I just stated, to pursue unpaid internships, which adds to challenges these students already face in graduating and gaining access to well-paying jobs. Well, maybe you mandate that if you're going to participate in a program with unpaid interns, maybe you also have to have a certain number of interns who are paid, whose family's household income equals less than $100,000 a year or something like that. I mean, I'm just kind of spitballing here. But what these writers are saying is that 40% of college students lost an internship, job, or job offer in the spring of 2020. Nearly 60% of college students experienced food insecurity or homelessness in early 2020. That was a statistic that surprised me, worsening these two longstanding and widespread problems. So to make matters worse is the fact that many students will soon be graduating into an economy with high unemployment. And I disagree with the writers that want to ban unpaid internships. I think internships should be encouraged. I think internships are great. I'd love to see a system where states and the federal government maybe even offer employers tax breaks to incentivize them to hire both. The proposing is a hybrid system of paid and unpaid internships. Now, I get that it's working for free. And I remember when I was interning for the Brooklyn Cyclones many years ago, an intern was answering the phone. And that was something that in the place of the receptionist. And that was something that a paid worker usually did. And the person was off and the intern stepped in and was doing her job. So I was overhearing a conversation between two of the staffers. And one of them said to the other, well, you know, I think maybe we can get an intern for this. And I said to me, said to them, and I was so naive at the time, well, the interns work for free, right? And they said, yeah. And you guys all get paid to do your jobs, right? They said, yeah. Well, why wouldn't they just have an intern do that all the time and save the cost of paying a receptionist or paying someone else? And the woman's name was Anna. Anna, who's now a big star in the sports management world. That's a story for another day. But Anna said to me, well, I guess we could all be replaced by interns, in which, remember, I'm an intern at the time, in which case I said, well, no, we can't. No, I certainly can't. And then my friend Vic, who was watching this conversation, he said, well, yeah, that's because you are an intern. So I'd love your thoughts on this. Do you agree with the authors of this article that it's time to end unpaid internships? Or do you agree with me that it's time to preserve and maybe fix unpaid internships? 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. I'm going to link to their column so you can read it for yourself. That's at facebook.com/MoranoFan. That's facebook.com/MoranoFan. We have the AC report coming up at 3:30 with the former executive director of the CRDA, Thomas Carver. I'm very much looking forward to that conversation. But first, let me hear from you. 1-800-848-9222. Rob, you've been in radio a bit. You must have done some internships somewhere.
Yeah, I interned at a radio station on Long Island for two semesters.
Good experience?
It was a lot of phone surveying stuff. You're like, hi, my name is so-and-so, and I'm doing a college research project on the musical taste of the people between 25 and 54.
So would you agree with the people that say you should put an end to these unpaid internships, or do you think there's some value to them?
You know, the only thing I learned about it was how to handle myself on the phone, because sometimes people would scream and or whatever. And you know, it'd be nice if for unpaid internship, you know, when you're giving out free T-shirts or having free food or something, let the intern get in line first.
I agree with that. I agree with that. I remember I was interning here. And Molly, how about you? Have you interned? Where did you intern? What kind of place? I'm not hearing her if she's talking.
I've interned a few times. I've interned at radio stations. I've interned for political campaigns. I've interned for tech startups. But I would say on the topic of internships, I would say do it once. If you're going to do an unpaid internship, do it once. Because after that, people are just going to start taking advantage of you. Like, people won't stop themselves for hiring you for an unpaid position, even though you're worth money. So I would say internships are great. Like my internship, I worked at a radio station in Newark, and I was able as a 19-year-old to produce features of my own. So that was amazing. But I don't know, internships, you know.
So do you think unpaid internships should be banned?
After my last one, yes.
Oh, you did not have a good experience at your last one.
And the one before that, no. I also didn't have a good experience.
Well, you can't
there,
make public policy based on individual circumstances. In general, do you think it should be legal for a company to hire an unpaid intern and give them college credit in exchange for money, instead of money, I should say?
I think generally speaking, unpaid labor is exploitative.
All right. Well, that is increasingly the consensus in the legal community. So I might be in the minority on this one. I kind of think that whether it's Rob, Molly, me, or somebody else, I think internships, especially in very competitive fields, I think internships, including unpaid, is part of paying your dues And again, I realize it's much easier for me to say that than it was for my wife to say that, because she always had to work, even as a 19 or a 20-year-old, whereas I was still living at home and I didn't, you know, I didn't have to do that. 800-848-WABC. I'd love to hear your thoughts. 1-800-848-9222. Rick is in New Jersey. Hello, Rick.
Good morning, Frank. A couple of things. First of all, on the what we were just talking about, the internship, I agree with you, except I don't think they should get college credit, because that just – they should be given a job when they finish learning how to do that job. Don't you think, you know, instead of having, like, paying someone to learn, you learn, then you get the job. But just getting credit, I don't know if that's worth it anymore with college, you know.
I'm not sure I follow what you're saying, Rick.
Okay, you said that you do an internship and then you get college credit for it. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, that's how it was when I was in school.
Right. Well, wouldn't it have been better if you got that actual job or a job similar to that,
well,
or at least a
right.
job in the company where you could work yourself up?
Right, but that's the thing.
Go get your own job.
Yeah, but that's the thing that I did, right? So being an intern at this radio station, for instance, not only did it give me my first on-air experience, not only did it teach me how to phone screen and how to edit audio and how to book guests, but it gave me it provided, after I graduated from school, I already had a job. So I think there were other places I interned where there were job offers from them as well. So I think that that's the point, is these internships do lead to jobs very often.
Well, I think it's a 50-50 thing. It depends on the company that's giving you the internship and how well they're treating you and all that, whether or not it's worth it. I think who you just were talking to, I think with Molly, was it? And mm-hmm. she said one she didn't want to, and one she did. I think it depends on how you're treated as to whether you think it was good for you or not. Because sometimes they might have you do stuff that really doesn't help you in the job. It's just they need you to copy things or something. You know what I mean?
I hear you. I hear you, Rick. And look, I'm not – and thanks for the call, Rick. I am not unsympathetic to the argument that if an intern wasn't doing something – then that would be something that a paid staffer would have to do. However, I still think there's some value in it. I remember when I was wanting to work in radio, and I always knew I wanted to work in radio, I wrote to all my favorite talk show hosts, and only a handful of them wrote back. And I asked all of them for practical advice. And one of my favorite talk show hosts happened to be from my neighborhood, although he had moved to California by the time he was on the radio. He's still great, and he's still a good friend, Brian Whitman. And I said, Brian, I am desperate to be a talk show host one day. What can I do? If you tell me 100 things, 1 through 100, I will do each and every one. How do I do it? He said, the first thing he said is, Frank, and I don't know if he remembers it, he said, Frank, it's very important for you to get in a radio station, to be inside a radio station. Because once you're inside a radio station, once you're there coming in every day, all sorts of opportunities present themselves. Opportunities to be on air, opportunities to produce content, opportunities to learn. That has to be your number one priority. And I said, well, I just applied to be an intern at WABC. And sure enough, the rest is history. 800-848-WABC. We'll get into some other topics as well. And again, I'm getting a lot of people asking about the segment we did on shadow people. Heidi Hollis is a real expert on that, and we're going to have her back soon to talk about aliens and some other things. But if you want to learn more about what we were talking about, go to her website, HeidiHollis.com. That's HeidiHollis.com. I've gotten a dozen emails in the last 5 minutes asking, what was that lady's name? What was that? Shadow people and the what man? The hat man. Pretty ominous, pretty scary. It's the kind of thing. It's exactly the kind of reason I love being on overnight radio. If you're just tuning in, make sure you go back and listen to the podcast. You can find it at WABCradio.com. I want to take a few more calls here, and then we're going to get to Thomas Carver, the former executive director of the Casino Redevelopment Authority. Nikki is in Manhattan. Hello, Nikki.
Hi, Frank. I agree that the internship should be maintained. And my opinion is when you get those valuable skills, you're really getting free training. Like you said, you learned editing and all kinds of skills that in a classroom may not have been as practical as doing the actual work. Plus, I wanted to ask you, if you get the college credit, does that exempt you from paying for those credits?
It's such a good question. I tried that when I was at NYU. I said to my advisor, I said, look, these three credits that I'm getting for this internship, you're not paying an NYU staffer to instruct me. I'm not coming into an NYU building using up NYU's electricity. I'm not taking up a spot in a classroom that could go to another student. And they basically said, you're right, but tough. Yes, you still have to pay. You still had to pay for those credits. Yes.
Well, maybe that's something that could be amended.
Yeah, you know, that is a great point and a great idea. Maybe if the colleges want to maintain their tax exempt status, maybe they have to make credits that are done because of an internship. Maybe they have to make them free for the students. That's a great idea, Nikki. And I have to tell you, it's one I wouldn't have thought of. Well done.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nikki. 800-848-9222. We've got the AC report coming up in a few minutes. We'll continue with a few more of your calls, 800-848-9222. I do want to tell you, though, about Life Change Tea. I had two refreshing glasses of Life Change Tea as soon as I got up in the afternoon. What a way to start the afternoon, especially on a nice, hot day. It was so refreshing. It's delicious. Now, what is Life Change Tea? Life Change Tea gives you a ton of energy without caffeine. Dominic Carter asked me before I went on air tonight. He said, Frank, after the first hour, don't you ever get tired? Here's the God's honest truth. No! Because, first of all, I get a real kick out of doing this. I get a ton of adrenaline doing this. But I think a big part of the reason is these Life Change Tea. There's this powerful herbal proprietary formula that gives you a ton of energy without caffeine. It also tastes great. I'm drinking a batch of the pomegranate right now. There are no fillers, no GMOs. It's completely organic. It's a mild cleanse and a daily detox that cleanses you from the inside out. Their slogan is the tea that makes you go. And boy, oh boy, does it make you go. Read the testimonials for yourself at getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. And if you order some of this, go and you use the promo code Frank, you can get free shipping anywhere in these United States. Try it. You'll like it. Getthetea.com. Promo code Frank. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. That was Eminem singing Lose Yourself. You know, that's from the film 8 Mile, a terrific film. And the best thing about a movie is to have low expectations for it, because I went into that film not expecting anything special. This is going back 18 years, but I was just blown away. I thought it was phenomenal. Kim Basinger is great. And Eminem, who I've never been the biggest fan of, he's got a few good songs, but Eminem as an actor in that film, he's phenomenal. He's absolutely phenomenal. 800-848-9222. We're going to do the AC report in just a minute. I do want to say one thing. You know what the city ought to do, and for that matter, every city in America, they ought to do a better job informing people of things. Now, in the current day and age, when people have email, when there's radio stations, there's television stations, there's newspapers, there's text messaging, let me give you one premise. So, for whatever reason, my house, there's a lot of bugs around it, outside. And my wife tells me, this was after some recent gambling winnings, she said, well, you know, you're not going to get to keep all that. I have to hire an exterminator because I see wasps all outside and I don't want to get stung and I don't want anybody that visits to get stung. I said, fine. And she said, by the way, every time night comes, mosquitoes are all over the place. And I don't feel like getting all these bites. I said, well, fine. We'll have them spray for mosquitoes and wasps. So lo and behold, this all happened while I was sleeping. My father and stepmother came over for something. I don't remember why. Well, I was asleep. And my wife cautions them and says, hey, be careful. You don't want to get stung. There are wasps all over the place. And, well, my dad says, where? And she says, right there, under the steps there. I think there's a nest. And lo and behold, he goes and gets this wasp-killing spray. And he sprays down this wasp nest. And you see all the wasps dying. And again, I wasn't witness to any of this. This is all secondhand. And my wife feels bad. Even though she wants the wasps to die, she feels bad seeing them suffer and kind of flail around a little bit before they ultimately die. Wasps taken care of. My wife says, great. Now I just have to do something about all the mosquitoes. That's my pronunciation, not hers. And my stepmother says, well, don't you know? The city is spraying your neighborhood for mosquitoes tomorrow night. So lo and behold, we canceled the exterminator, saved $350. Now there's no more wasps and no more mosquitoes. Had my stepmother not told us about some random flyer that she saw on a telephone pole somewhere, we would have paid to have an exterminator come and spray all over the place for mosquitoes. So I have to tell you, I don't care whether it's Boston, New York, Wheeling, West Virginia, Charlotte, North Carolina. These cities ought to inform the residents when they're going to spray for mosquitoes, not only so they can bring all their stuff in and not get this malathion or whatever they use covering all their outdoor furniture, but so that they don't waste money on an exterminator. That's my two cents. We'll do the AC report next. This is the other side of midnight, straight ahead.
Your law.
All right, this is the other side of midnight. Make no mistake, it is Thursday morning at 3:30, time for the AC report. And I am just thrilled at the gentleman that is joining us this morning. He was the executive director of the CRDA, the Casino Redevelopment Authority. Now, if you've read an article about anything that's happened in Atlantic City for the last 40 years, if you have been to Atlantic City over the last 30 or 40 years, chances are almost anything that's being done in Atlantic City is in some way a byproduct of the CRDA. Now, if there's a free concert that you've been to, it's put on by the CRDA. If there's some new sort of attraction on the boardwalk, chances are that was put on by the CRDA. If there's lobbying on behalf of improvements that need to be made to the boardwalk or some other areas, chances are that lobbying is done by the CRDA. And I am thrilled to welcome a man who has worn many hats in his career, but including the former executive director of the Casino Redevelopment Authority, Thomas Carver. Mr. Carver, thanks so much for joining me on the radio.
My pleasure. How are you?
I'm doing great. I realize it's possibly a little bit of an inconvenient time, so I appreciate you joining us so early.
No, it's my pleasure. Good to talk to you.
It's great to talk with you, and I have a number of questions for you about Atlantic City. But first, I actually understand that you are the grandfather of our telephone talent coordinator, Molly, and I have to compliment you. She has now, in a very short time, become absolutely integral to this show. She is one of the most professional and terrific young people I've ever worked with, and I know you've got to be very proud.
Well, that's nice to hear. I think Molly is going to do some great things in his life. I really do. I'm very, very happy that she's with you and over there in New York. And I just think that it's the beginning of a great career for her. I really do.
Well, in spite of the fact that she's with me, I agree with you. She's poised for doing a lot of great things. So, Mr. Carver, if people aren't familiar with the CRDA, what exactly is it? What does it do, or what did it do?
Well, the CRDA is a state agency which is funded by 1.25% of the casino gross revenue on an annual basis, which makes it, in my judgment, one of the great economic development agencies anywhere, because frankly, it doesn't have to rely on stipends from the legislature every year, you know, they, which go up and down, and if who's mad at who gets the money and whatnot. So it's always been a great, great source of the wonderful things in Atlantic City, frankly. And the statute, by the way, some of the things that you were mentioned about the CRDA putting on concerts and whatnot is a result of a change in the statute which took place just after I left Atlantic City, whereby the previously the way the formula worked is that in the first few years, all of the money would stay in Atlantic City for Atlantic City development. And after that, by formula, money would be dispersed to North Jersey and South Jersey in decreasing amounts or increasing amounts depending on the year. But when they changed the statute, a lot of things happened. When all the money stayed in Atlantic City, one of the first things they did was they devoted money to paying down Atlantic City's debt, which was phenomenal. Atlantic City always had an obese budget. Very frankly, over the years, it was, I'd tell people what it was, and they just couldn't believe me how a city of 34,000 could have one of the largest budgets in the state of New Jersey. But unfortunately, in many respects, Atlantic City has never changed. The mistake was made very early on when Brendan Byrne and the legislature passed the law to have casinos. Once it was passed by the voters, he wanted to put in a regional commission similar to the Hackensack Meadowlands Development Commission to oversee the development of Atlantic City. But he was talked out of it. So he always had the problem of the state's agenda, which was different from the city's agenda, and was no vision as to what Atlantic City should be. So we fought that battle for many, many years. By the way, before I was executive director of the Port Authority, listen to me, CRDA, I spent 9 years as the first president of the Casino Association. Mm. I represented at that time there were 12 casinos in town, and we started out from day one with no friends, a lot of enemies and whatnot, and a very, very anti-casino administration in Trenton under Tom Kane, and we built it up to a very, very good organization. And I went to Atlantic City. I used to be run the operation at Newark Airport before I went there, but I went to Atlantic City. One of the reasons was I really wanted to help try to make that a great town. I always talk in terms of greatness for Atlantic City. And I must say I'm probably still one of the optimists that thinks that's possible. I have some very, very dear friends down there who tell me if I went down and kept my eyes closed and opened them up, I'd see the Atlantic City that was always there and never going to change. So it's a very difficult city to get change done in, because you don't have that common image and common vision as to where you want to get to, you know?
No, that's for sure, and that's been my experience, not just as an observer, not being an insider like you were. Now, I know you left around 2011 when there was certainly a lot of changes going on in Atlantic City. How long did you head the CRDA for? How long were you there for?
I was down there for about 5 years. I was Commissioner of Labor under Cody, and he asked me at the end of his term if I would go back to Atlantic City. Which was about, I'm going to say, 2005, 2006 in that era. I thought when he left office, I would probably end up going home, but I stayed during the Corzine administration, and I lasted about a month or 2 months under Chris Christie. So I was there for about 5 or 6 years. So we got some things done. We redid the boardwalk. We built the garage next to the walk. We finished the rest of the walk, which is, of course, the entrance area of Atlantic City with all those great stores. So we did get some things done. But there were a great many things I wanted to do, frankly, that for a lot of reasons we weren't able to get finished.
I understand even though you were working in Atlantic City when you were with the CRDA, you were actually living in Spring Lake, which is a ways away from Atlantic City. What's that commute like?
I used to commute, well, I'll tell you the truth, for almost 15 years prior to going back. But when I went back, it was another five. I commuted 150 miles a day. And believe it or not, it didn't really bother me, frankly, because I was always going in the other direction. I mean, people would be traveling north in traffic jams, and I'd be going south in the morning, and then in late at night, I'd be coming home the other way. So it really wasn't too bad. And frankly, it was good to get out of the atmosphere.
Sure.
Very frankly. I had a family at the time, young kids at the time, and frankly, I didn't want my youngest daughter dancing on crap tables, you know?
Understandable. I hope you had a driver at least.
In the end, I did. When I went back there, I did because the driver they made me take a driver when I was Commissioner of Labor, and he decided to come with me when I went down to Atlantic City. So I had him for a while, but then after a while, I drove myself, and I didn't mind that.
So when you left in 2011, that's mm-hmm. when I would say Atlantic City was almost at a low point. You saw right after that five casinos close in quick succession, taking with them the thousands of jobs in each one and all the tax revenue that those workers bring with them. I'm wondering, what other major changes did you notice from when you first arrived there, when you were the spokesman for the Atlantic City Casino Association back in the 80s to when you left as the head of the CRDA in 2011?
Well, I have to tell you, the reason we had predicted, very frankly, we tried desperately to get sports wagering in 90, 91, 92, and 93. We had made some great changes in the Casino Control Act, which, very frankly, we got 24-hour gaming, and we got other things that were done that would help the industry a great deal. But I told Jim Florio and everyone who listened to us that without sports wagering, we're going to lose our insurance policy. And New Jersey missed a great opportunity because we could have had a monopoly on East Coast sports wagering, and we could have kept it for years. And unfortunately, we couldn't get it through the legislature, and we lost that. We got a one-year window. I went down and I testified before the House Judiciary Committee after the by the way, I don't want to get into details that you don't want to listen to, but we got a one-year window. New Jersey was the only state in the union which got a one-year window to decide if they wanted to do sports wagering on their own when they passed the bill banning it nationally, except for five states that were grandfathered in. And we thought we had a great shot, but we didn't get it. But we predicted at that time, if in fact we did not get it and casinos began to open elsewhere in the region, we would just suffer badly. We would lose some casinos. We predicted that, and that's exactly what happened. But you're right. We were at a low point at that point when I left.
Now, I know your family was in the newspaper business. You yourself mm-hmm. were a journalist pretty early on and then mm-hmm. an attorney. How do you go from being a journalist and an attorney and the commissioner of the Department of Labor to Atlantic City? What attracted you to Atlantic City to work with the Atlantic City Casino Association to begin with?
Well, I had very frankly, I had decided to leave the Port Authority and I needed a job. And we had a consultant in the Port Authority by the name of Tony Ciccatello, a very well-known operator in the state of New Jersey. And he had been representing the association as one of his clients for a few years. And he asked me for about a year and a half for names of people who might be interested in trying to get the job. This was the new president of the Casino Association. And when I decided to leave the Port Authority, I said to him, Tony, what's that job you're always talking about? And he told me about it. And I said, well, I'd like to maybe put my name in. He said, Tom, you'd be great. I've been telling him I needed a Jersey street guy for years. So I went down there and I had about 10 interviews. And the last time I went, I finally told my wife, I said, look, I'm either going to get the job today or we're not going to come back anymore because I've been coming down here all the time, and every time I'd go, a different person would interview me. So I went into a room with 30 members of the industry and went through the interview, handed out a schedule and an agenda as to what I thought we should talk about, and they hired me the next day. But that's why how I got there. And I'll be honest with you, I'd never been in a casino in my life before.
Wow.
And I'd only been in Atlantic City once for 3 hours. So I had no real background at all.
Well, it sounds they chose well then.
I went to work every day for about 10 years in the morning, knowing that I could come home at night with no job. That's the kind of dynamic it was, frankly.
Wow. Do you think that the CRDA does enough? I've spoken with some casino owners and some casino executives that say, well, the CRDA really should be more like the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority, and they need to be doing more. What do you see as the role of the CRDA in Atlantic City's future?
I think that the CRDA, again, in my judgment, and this is not universally accepted, I suspect, but in my judgment, the CRDA is an economic development agency. And we should be doing everything we can to develop Atlantic City across the board. One of the reasons, and the major reason I left in 2011, was that they had come up with an idea for the tourism district.
Right.
And I didn't have any problem with the concept, but I felt that, very frankly, because the problem we had since the inception of gaming in Atlantic City was that we had two Atlantic cities. We had an agenda for the state. We had an agenda for the city, and they were never combined together in one. And I said the tourism district should encompass the entire city, because we don't want to continue this war of having the two cities, and it's always once again one against the other. And I got a lot of people mad at me. In fact, I did one thing. I united the whole state of New Jersey politically because both the Democrats and the Republicans were mad at me.
You're my kind of guy, believe me.
So,
I
had had, previous to that, I had some great relationships with the legislature and whatnot. But anyway, to make a long story short, Christie said he couldn't live with me in the job, so I resigned. And the next day, I said, look, I'm not going to be the one who destroys such a great budding political career, that I would kill him, so I left.
Last week, we saw the Atlantic City City Council vote to do away with the only needle exchange facility in the city. A lot of people were celebrating this. They're saying this is exactly what we don't need in a city that's trying to attack tourists. And a lot of other people were saying it's only going to lead to more drug overdoses and more people getting HIV. What do you think about the idea of a needle exchange facility in Atlantic City?
Well, number one, the city has always felt with some degree of consistency and some logic that it is the receptor of everybody's problems. In other words, we used to have the problems with the Mission, and they would claim that people would be put on buses and sent to Atlantic City because Atlantic City had a Mission. So the feeling about having those kinds of elements in the town has always been very resented by the city itself. We had that problem for a long time with respect to drug business in Atlantic City. The first thing that could have been done, frankly, and probably would have been best, is if they could, rather than get rid of it, is move it and put it back maybe on Back Rack Boulevard near the Mission or something like that. But the town has always been reluctant about having anything move from anywhere else in town to their area. It's not in my backyard type syndrome. So that was a problem. I think that, very frankly, if you listen to the people who are advocates of the program, that they're probably correct in the fact that there will be people who suffer as a result of not having the availability of that service. And conversely, I understand that the city doesn't like to see that type of thing in the midst of the tourism district. So I think it's going to be a matter of debating, not debating, but a matter of seeing who's right and wrong in terms of what the effect is going to be.
Final question. There was a poker player who is suing the Borgata over a lifetime ban. Apparently, he went to check in. He made a joke about suicide. They forced him to go see a mental health professional. Then they removed him from his room and told him he was banned for life. He's suing for about $1.5 million. Where do you see that case going? I know you're an attorney as well. What's your opinion?
I don't know. I think that, very frankly, I suspect he's going to lose, to be honest with you, because they do have the right to ban certain people for certain activities. I don't know the seriousness of what his allegations were or the statements that he made, frankly, but I don't know. It's an interesting case. I think, very frankly, he might be on the losing end.
And then, I know I said that was finally, but I'll end with this. If you had to pick, gun to your head, favorite restaurant in Atlantic City, what would it be?
I always liked Doc's Oyster House, and I like the Knife and Fork, two of the older ones. They're really great.
Can't go wrong with either of those.
Great restaurants. They really do.
That's for sure. Thomas Carver, former executive director of the Casino Redevelopment Authority and the grandfather of our own Molly, thanks so much for joining me on the radio this morning.
That's fine. I hope I haven't bored you.
No, please, not in the least. Thank you very much, Thomas Carver. If you want to comment, 800-848-9222. Some breaking news out of Disney World in just a moment. This is The Other Side of Midnight, straight ahead.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. A few minutes before 4 o'clock, we'll get to your calls in just a minute. 800-848-9222. Within the last few hours, a little bit of breaking news.
Breaking news, WABC.
Disney World will require customers to start wearing masks indoors and on public transit starting on Friday after the CDC recommended indoor mask mandates in areas experiencing spikes in COVID cases. Now, the Orlando area theme park had eased mask requirements for vaccinated guests after the CDC told inoculated Americans they could ditch masks in May. This is absolutely ridiculous. Look, this is not affecting me because I'm not going to be at Disney World within the next month, 2 months, 3 months, year. But, you know, maybe when I have a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old, he'll probably want to go to Disney World. This is ridiculous. If I'm vaccinated, I've got to wear a mask at Disney World. What the heck is the point in getting vaccinated? So you get vaccinated, even though we're told this Delta variant is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. You get vaccinated. Oh, look, here's your reward for getting vaccinated. You still have to wear a mask when you're waiting online when it's 90 degrees. It's ridiculous. You're welcome to disagree as you see fit. 800-848-WABC. How about if you, first of all, I think the jury is, and people may get upset when I say this, the jury is somewhat out on whether simple cloth coverings of your face are terribly effective in preventing COVID transmission. Now, there's no doubt that an N95 or a KN95 mask certainly is effective in terms of reducing COVID transmission. But if you have to bring back this mask mandate, why not just bring it back for the unvaccinated? They're the ones that are causing the problem to begin with. How about those of us that are vaccinated? We show our vaccination card and we're able to go in and not wear a mask. I think it's ridiculous. Oh, you get vaccinated, you still have to wear a mask. Give me a break. 800-848-9222. You're welcome to disagree. Let me say hello to E. Frank in Astoria, who's been patiently holding. Hello, E. Frank.
Yes, good morning, Frank. I'm calling you because I wanted to discuss something that you, one of the topics that you were talking about in the previous hour about internships. You know, you did get those letters that back then about the different talk show hosts, or the handful of letters that you stated. You did, you know, they did respond to you back then.
Yeah, I'm sorry, E. Frank. I'm not following you.
Anyway, look, I don't believe in internships, Frank. You know why? I was an ROTC cadet at one time. I had a Pell and Tap grant. I've been out of college for 31 years. I had to drop out because internships actually hurt me. Many of the persons that I knew did college work study. They decided to do internships because they believed they would get hands-on experience by doing that. I actually believe that having a professional instructor, having a solid college courses, financing your education correctly can help. But wasting time on an internship that's not going to give you solid experience in the long run, I don't think that's an effective thing.
I hear you, E. Frank. And I guess, look, different people have different experiences. I can tell you in my experience, it was invaluable. I am still using every day some of the skills I learned from being an intern, not only at this radio station, but at the Brooklyn Cyclones and at the Fox News Channel. So, You know what? Different strokes for different folks. All right. After 77 seconds of news, we'll come your way. We'll continue to take your calls. 800-848-9222.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. So, if you're like me, you forget which celebrities are married to who. I can't keep track. Who's J-Lo dating? I don't know. I don't care. If they're happy, I'm happy. But one of the many celebrity couples that I had forgotten were a couple were Ashton Kutcher and Mila Kunis. They were both on the show, That 70s Show, and I think Ashton Kutcher went on to marry Demi Moore. They had a couple of kids together, I believe, or at least stepchildren. I don't know if they had biological kids. I don't know. I'm not an expert in this stuff. But now he's with Mila Kunis, and I was fascinated. The only reason I know this is because there was this big article about them that I saw on CNN. And I've told you, now that I'm a parent-to-be, I'm much more attuned to articles about, you know, parenting and things like that. So they evidently appeared on an episode, and I should have pulled the audio. I didn't think to do it before the show. They appeared on an episode of Dax Shepard's Armchair Expert podcast, and the talk turned to, of all things, bathing. So after the host of the podcast, Dax Shepard, told the co-host, Monica Padman, that using soap every day rids the body of natural oils, Kutcher and Kunis agreed, saying they only wash vitals every day. Padman was stunned to be in the daily full body wash minority and asked, "Who taught you not to wash?" Kunis said, "I didn't have hot water growing up as a child, so I didn't shower very much anyway." And this apparently has continued with their two children. They have a 6-year-old named Wyatt and a 4-year-old named Dimitri. Kunis said, "I wasn't that parent that bathed my newborns ever." And now that they're older, Kutcher said they have a system. If you can see the dirt on them, clean them. Otherwise, there's no point. Kutcher said he does wash his armpits and, quote, "my crotch daily and nothing else ever. And he has a tendency to throw some water on my face after a workout to get all the salts out." Well, that's kind of gross to not work out after a workout, I'll say. Kunis said she washes her face twice a day. So this goes hand in hand with other research that we've seen before and other articles that we've seen before, that part of the problem with American society these days, especially when it comes to children, is that they are too clean. I'm not joking about this. There are a lot of people that say when you use soap, you are, as the co-host of this podcast said, depriving your body of natural oils. That's why I have tried not to use soap. I do shower every day, just about every day. But I have tried not to use soap anywhere except on my under my armpits and, you know, in my groin area. But I am fascinated by what these two have said here, that they only give their children a bath if they can see dirt on them. I'm curious what you think of this approach. Should a child, whether we're talking a 6-month-old or a 4-year-old, should a child bathe every day? Or as Kutcher, Kunis, and the two co-hosts of this podcast seem to believe, and other researchers, not just a bunch of Hollywood lunatics that believe this, should you bathe them less, maybe only when they're dirty? Because I'll be honest, I'm going to try and make the case to my wife that it should be the latter. What say you? 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. How long or how often should you bathe children? So there are all sorts of people that are mocking this on social media. A lot of memes have popped up over this. But I'm actually taking this pretty seriously. And I actually think there's some validity to this. And I think it is backed up by the research. Ashton Kutcher and Mila Kunis say there's no point in bathing every day. What say you? They say they don't bathe themselves or their children all that often. 800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Corey on Long Island. Hello, Corey.
Hey, what's up, Frank? First off, couldn't agree more about the bathing thing. Second off, though, listen, dude.
So how often do you bathe, Corey?
I take a shower every day, but just the construction work. I don't know nothing, but I've heard the research, too, and everything on the skin and the soap and whatnot.
Interesting. Okay. Go ahead. What was your other point?
Hollywood's right about something, I guess. And it's Mila.
What did I say? Mila?
Yeah.
See, I can never get either that way. One right. That's one of those ones that I have like a mental block. Mila. So wait. Mila is the correct. Oh, no. Mila is the correct. Mila?
Mila.
Okay.
Mila.
Okay.
That's how she always said it going on the Stern show. Is Mila.
Mila. Got it. Mila Kunis. Got it.
Anyways, more importantly, enough's enough, Frank. Come on, with the tyranny and believing the lies with the vaccine. You're part of the propaganda by, you know, this is America. We don't wear masks, whether you're vaccinated or not. Everybody's got to start taking a stand. Enough of the tyranny. This is enough's enough. And it just makes me sick to even hear someone like yourself just believe the lie with the vaccine and the mask and everything else. It's time to take back America.
So, Corey, I guess you're not vaccinated. Is that you hung up. I wanted to have a conversation with the guy. He seemed like such a nice guy. I wanted to talk to him. 800-848-9222. I didn't hang up on him. He hung up. 1-800-848-WABC. Melvin is in the Boogie Down Bronx. Melvin, how often should I bathe my future child?
Every day, because cleanliness is controlling my personal hygiene, developing the fortitude to maintain and pick up behind yourself. Because when you stop cleaning up your own personal body, that means you're not going to clean up behind yourself at all. You're going to let yourself go. And that's when infection sets in. The medical profession has a saying, 3-3-3. The average person can have 3 minutes without air, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food. So if you feel that you can go without putting cleansing up your body, that's on you. I'm a firm believer in self-preservation. And I do not want to be around anyone who does not believe in maintaining a clean and healthy hygiene era. All you got to do is look at the military. If the military run around being filthy, you can smell them before you see them. And that's what animals and insects do. They smell you before they even see you, so they know where you at. So you want to go around smelling funky and filthy and have your child smelling funky and filthy because they lack the fortitude and the consideration to respect other people. That's on you. Now, I want you to stay away from me. I do not want you to bring your filthy habits next to me.
All right, Melvin. Wow. Well, there is something called the hygiene hypothesis. When you were in school, how many kids, depending on how old you are, how many kids in your fifth grade class had an allergy to peanuts? Did you ever bring a peanut butter and jelly sandwich to school? They did in my school. In fact, they served them at the cafeteria every day. If you bought lunch at school, which I did when I was in elementary school, if you bought lunch at school, and you didn't like what any of the options were, you didn't like this French bread pizza or the sloppy Joe that was a little too sloppy for your taste or whatever the case may be, then you always had the option of peanut butter and jelly. That is absolutely not the case in schools these days. If you go into a school these days and you try and open up a peanut butter sandwich, they will swarm on you as if you are about to detonate a bomb. That's only slightly an exaggeration. Now, with reason, because there's a whole lot more children that have developed allergies these days than there were, food allergies specifically, than there were 20, 30, 40 years ago. Now, there's a lot of theories as to why that's the case, but one of the leading hypotheses about this is the hygiene hypothesis. And it says essentially that once that kids are cleaning too much, and that because there are no germs for your body to attack, your body starts attacking itself with things like allergies and things like autoimmune diseases. And there's a great book, and I've spoken with the author several times. It's called An Elegant Defense, and it's by Matt Richtel. Wonderful book. It's all about your body and the immune system. And one of the experts in this book points to some data which shows that children who have a lot of siblings have fewer allergies. And children who have pets have fewer allergies. And the theory is that because children with siblings get exposed to not only their siblings' germs, but all the germs of the children that their brothers and sisters interact with, that they build up a resistance and their body fights off those germs. The same thing with pets. You interact with these pets that are rolling around in dirt all day long. Your body attacks those germs instead of attacking itself. I think there's something to this. And I think there's some merit to what Ashton Kutcher and Mila Kunis are doing. 800-848-WABC. I'm going to make the case to my wife that we should not bathe their child every day unless you can provide compelling suggestions otherwise. 800-848-9222. Carol is in New Jersey. Hello, Carol.
Oh, Frank, I have so many things I could talk to you about. You're right about that, the allergy factor, because I didn't develop any kind of allergies until I was like 40 years old. So I don't know how that happens, but.
Well, I've heard that happening before.
Yeah. Look, yeah.
It could be crazy. A number of factors.
Yeah. And also, I had an internship when I was a senior in college. I went to college in Westchester, and I worked for a professional theater company. And I got to see all the rehearsals and the play. We did Desire Under the Elm, Eugene O'Neill. And I did all kinds of administrative work, and it was fantastic. I didn't get paid for it. I got credits. I didn't get paid for it.
Well, that was exactly the same thing that happened with me. Same thing.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so Carol, it sounds like you.
Back then they didn't pay you. You got college credit for it. So.
Right. I mean, so it sounds like you and I are on the same page that these unpaid internships should continue.
But it was an excellent experience, though.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Well, thank you very much for the call there, Carol. 800-848-WABC. Tyrone is in the Boogie Down Bronx. Hello, Tyrone.
Yes, Frank. One of my best times listening to late night radio was Barry Farber and Long John Neville, the Gab and Gavel Man.
With what? I heard Barry Farber and Long John Neville, and then I couldn't make out what you said after that.
The gab, as in talk, the word gab, G-A-B, gab and gavel man.
Gab and gavel man.
Yeah, that's what it was called. Anyway, those are the two best I've ever heard. Once I had a chance to go to Barry Farber's place, broadcast for internship. Hopefully, I thought it would turn into that. But at the end of the evening, we were riding down in the elevator, and everybody was chatting. And then Larry turned to me and said, Tyrone, what did you think of the show? I mean, with my big mouth, I said to him, I said, well, it left a lot to be desired.
I'm sorry, I cut you off inadvertently, Tyrone. Sorry about that. Call back if you want to finish the thought. 800-848-9222. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. That was my error. We'll continue with your calls in just a minute. 800-848-9222. I will tell you this, that if you are suffering from chronic pain, there's no need to, because in most of those cases, you can be treated at Trinity Rehab. These are the folks that will restore your freedom to live your life pain-free. Don't be fooled. It's not your father's physical therapy. It's cutting edge, state of the art stuff. They have something called the EPAP machine. It's FDA approved non-surgical acoustic pressure wave technology. It's similar to what they use to break up kidney stones. It breaks up scar tissue. It enhances healing and it gets rid of pain fast. It's effective for conditions like back pain, neck pain, tennis elbow, shoulder tendonitis, plantar fasciitis, even knee pain. Just 3 5-minute sessions, you could be virtually pain-free. No prescription needed to get started. They're all over New Jersey. Open in Clifton, Paramus, Wayne, Short Hills, Emerson, East Windsor, Shrewsbury, and a brand new location in Woodbridge. Call Trinity Rehab at 800-518-0977. That's 800-518-0977. Or go to trinity-rehab.com. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno, 21 minutes after 4 o'clock. Let me say hello to, and we're taking your calls at 800-848-9222. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about this story with Mila Kunis and Ashton Kutcher. They say they don't bathe themselves very much, and they don't bathe their children very much. I'm wondering if this is a strategy that makes sense. Let me say hello to Mike in Yonkers. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Frank. Last minute, Mike here. Listen. That whole thing started 40 years ago with antibacterial soap. You don't want to use antibacterial soap on your body, on your hands, your face, nowhere, because what it does is it destroys the fauna of your skin, causing you to get all kinds of
stuff. Mike, can you do me a favor? Can you turn your radio off, please?
Okay, I didn't think it was on. Hold on.
It's definitely on, because the show sounds
pretty good.
All
right, go ahead. Very low. Yeah, so antibacterial soap is a killer. It destroys the skin. It destroys your natural oils. Regular soap like Dove or whatever, who does something soft, really not so bad. I mean, you could brush your teeth without toothpaste, so you can wash without soap. But, yeah, if you overdo it, you're going to destroy your skin. You're going to destroy your oil. Now, that's one thing. The other thing is the cat that you were watching the other night, right? Do you still have it?
Unfortunately, yes. He's going back to his parents tonight by 10 p.m. Trust me, my wife is counting down the days. This cat, Mike, let me just tell you, this cat has now figured out, and I've never seen this with a cat before, he's figured out how to open the door of the bedroom that he's in. He opens the door and escapes. It's extraordinary.
Okay, now wasn't he going into your crawl space?
He was, but we sealed it.
Okay, now let me ask you a question. Your house, I don't want to know. You don't have to tell me in detail. Do you have branches, large trees next to your house, overhanging your house?
I mean, I wouldn't say they're too close, but there are trees around. There's a tree in the front yard.
Okay, I'm going to tell you what that cat's doing, aside from being private and wanting to hide. They're hunter killers, Frank. They're hunter killers. They probably picked up a scent of a squirrel or something in your roof. Believe it or not, squirrels get under the shingles of the house. And they burrow in, and they make nests, and then they leave. You know, they die in there. Who knows? So he could very well be picking up the scent of another creature and going up there and trying to investigate. You know, he's not being evil. He's not being malicious. He's not saying, hey, this is Frank Morano's house. I'm going to go break his chops.
Well, so you gotta, no, I can understand that. The cat actually seems pretty nice.
Very intelligent. A cat that opens up a door. Is super intelligent.
Yeah, but, you know, again, I don't think it's fair to the cats that live with us already. For instance, our cat Prissy had to hide the whole day. So the new one, the one that we're watching this week, his name's QWERTY. QWERTY got to roam around all day, and it caused Prissy to hide under the couch in my office all day. It's really not fair to her.
It's a domination thing. The other question is, a month or two ago, when your wife first got pregnant, and your cat was making number two or number one, whatever, in your bathtub. I was the one that called up and said the cat could sense a change. What's going on with that? Is that finished?
You know, it had quit for a few days, but when we moved the litter box back downstairs. But now he's doing it again.
They like clean environments. The cats like a clean environment, and that's why they're doing. I had who knows in my lifetime 30 cats, and they will do that. My daughter's cat does the same thing. Because the same thing goes, got the litter box, got the fluffy thing, and boop, there's the bathtub. Well, now use this thing, it's nice and clean. Look, man, that's also basically antibacterial soap. It's a killer. Don't use that on your skin because it'll cause warts, it'll cause all kinds of stuff.
That's in this book, An Elegant Defense, as well. They say the same thing about antibacterial soap. Thank you, Mike. 800-848-9222. Ed the Milkman is in New Jersey. Hello, Ed.
How you doing, Frank? You know what they say? Dirt don't hurt. So, you know, I'm sure when you were a kid, you played outside, you played in grass, weeds, everything else, climbed trees. And I can't believe it. It seems every kid today has some kind of allergies to something. I think it's just got out of control, really.
Yeah, well, that's why I am a believer in this hygiene hypothesis.
I agree with you.
So you don't... Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you don't think that we should bathe our child on a daily basis?
I guess it depends on the child and what happened that day. You know, if they got food spilled all over them or something, it's, you know, a different story. But
right, well, what if you use this Kuchar-Kunis criteria, which is if you see dirt on him, wash him, but if you don't, then don't.
Yeah, it's probably a pretty good theory.
Yeah, I like it. Thank you, Ed. 800-848-9222. Bambino is in Bay Ridge. Hello, Bambino.
Hey, Frank, how you doing? Listen, I grew up in Brooklyn in a railroad flat, you know, and the bathroom was the size of it was just a phone booth, you know, and we had five people, so we never really got a chance to get in the bathroom as much as we wanted to, you know. So, you know, every chance you got, it was Saturday night, you know, and then... I grew up pretty much that way, and, you know, you bathe once, twice a week, you use a little soap and blah, blah, blah. And now I'm 65 years old, and if I could say personally, I think my skin is beautiful.
So what does that end up with in terms of practical advice to me, Bambino?
I would say, if you're feeling it, do it. If you're not, hang out, you know?
All right, well,
'cause everybody feels... At a certain point, you're dirty.
Right.
If you don't feel it, don't worry about it.
Yeah. No, I like it. I like it, Bambino. Thank you. 800-848-9222. Rola is in New Jersey. Hello, Rola.
Yeah, Frank, I'm on Route 80, so I'm going to be quick. Newborns, you got to be careful because their immune system don't turn on to the eighth day. But that cheese that builds up on them, if they ingest that, they get some kind of I don't know the disease, but they get like a swollen brain and they have to tap the brain and drain the water, the fluid, encephalitis or something. Welfare babies, I was told, have to have a penicillin shot when they're born to prevent that, but private insurance does not pay for that. So it's something to that. I don't know. You're going to get a doctor and ask that, but you don't want to get that cheese and the bacteria on a newborn, especially if you have a girl, you got to learn to wipe up. And a boy that's not circumcised, you don't want that to get infected.
Sure.
But you got to look into that. You got to really be careful with that newborns.
Thank you, Rolla. 800-848-9222. Gordon is in Ottawa. Hello, Gordon.
Hi, I wanted to talk about your use of the word mosquitoes because it's very funny.
Thank you.
But the idea of Kunis wandering around unbathed, it just grosses me out.
Really? Okay.
Like, it's all right, children, I suppose, once or twice a week to have a bath. But adults, don't you think they should wash themselves once a day?
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out, because the research doesn't support that. In the rest of the world, they don't do these daily showers. And I think I'm over showering. I think I am going to end. Now, part of it is I enjoy a shower. I find it a little relaxing. I also find it potentially a little invigorating. But I think I'm over showering. Based on the research, I am going to end this 7 day a week stuff and maybe go to 5 days.
I don't think you can over shower. Like Frank Sinatra would shower 6 to 8 times a day.
Is that true?
Yes.
You know, I'm going to have to double check that with Joe Piscopo. You're going to want to listen to Joe Piscopo with the Ramsey Mazda Sundays with Sinatra show here on WABC from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. every Sunday night. And then he's followed by Dina Martin, who does this great show all about her father. She's got great stories about her father. Dean Martin, of course, great songs by her father. And one of the things that I'm potentially looking forward to is John Catsimatidis, as part of this ownership group. He owns our radio station, of course. As part of this ownership group of this Staten Island baseball team, he says they're going to look into a series of concerts there and maybe have Piscopo and Dina Martin, maybe even Tony Orlando, perform at that Richmond County Bank ballpark in St. George. I think that would be really quite something, and I think it'd be pretty popular. 800-848-WABC. Mike is in West Palm Beach. Hello, Mike.
Top of the morning, Frank. You know, I was laughing before, one of your pet peeves the other day. Yeah, can you please turn your radio off? You know, I got to say, you did a good job against my man Bernie, you know, with the questions. Couple of tough questions, but I did listen to that.
Terrible. I did terribly.
Nah, well, you know, the commodity of oil I would not have gotten, and then Missouri. But listen, two very smart guys going at it, you know. There's no reason in the world how you can not keep your kids clean. Whatever, you know, whatever the family background might be, and I don't know about, you know, I like Curtis Sliwa. He's got 16 cats, and you got some cats, but I can't get it. You know, I was laughing listening to the syndrome of, you know, what cats do and what they don't do. But if it was me, my two kids are older. We always kept them bathed, and maybe it's a part of a family philosophy, you know, with some people. But, you know, I can't wrap my mind around that, you know.
Right. Well, you can't wrap your mind around what Ashton Kutcher does and not bathing his child,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah, because it's a no-brainer. But, you know, maybe it's something Kutcher and his wife believed in, but it's not part of my belief. But that's, you know, that's just what makes radio go round and round. It's a good category.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate that. Thank you. You know what? You know what? One of the other reasons I end up showering is so I can shampoo my hair every day, because my hair, if I don't shampoo it, it goes in like five different directions. I can't really comb my hair unless I've washed it. It's just too rough. It's too resistant to people, you know, to anything, really. And additionally, I do have scalp psoriasis, so I feel like it helps the scalp psoriasis a little bit to do a daily shampoo with one of the psoriasis shampoos, whether it's tar or zinc or selenium sulfide. So I feel like, I mean, that's another reason that I end up showering regularly. But I'm going to look at reducing. I'm going to, you know, it's this week is – so starting, I think, next week, I'm going to look at doing 6 days, 6 showers a day instead of 7. We'll start with that. We'll see how it goes. Maybe I'll skip Saturday. Maybe I'll skip Saturday this week. We'll see. All right. 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. We'll continue with your phone calls and a whole lot more straight ahead.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
I try every trick in the book, with every step that you take, everywhere that you look, just look and you'll find. I'll try to get to your soul, I'll try to get to your mind.
Lou Christie, I'm going to make you mine. 800-848-9222. Rob, why do the songs keep cutting off like that?
I have no idea. They're all stopping at 37.
Oh, they're all stopping at 37. Okay. All right. Well, we'll hopefully we'll be able to figure that out for tomorrow. It is a little abrupt. All right. Hey, so I was surprised to see that sort of surprised that this plumber who I know, who's been politically active in New York for years, was arrested in Brooklyn and charged in this Capitol riot. Daniel Christman, I've known him for a long time. Not a long time. I guess I met him about 3 years ago. I was moderating a forum for people that wanted to run for public advocate, and he came, and he was – I met him before that because he wanted to do a radio show. He does still do a radio show on another station. It's a paid show where you pay and you get to do a show. And he was looking at doing it maybe at the station that I was working at. And I thought he was eccentric but nice. And then he came and said he wanted to run for public advocate. And he was speaking at a forum that I was moderating. And the guy was unhinged. The guy was totally unhinged. He was screaming for 3.5 straight minutes, just went crazy. It was one of those things. He was so unhinged, it made everybody else uncomfortable. And Curtis, who was with me at this forum, he said to me, that guy is great. That guy could be a star. So when I was producing a television show on Newsmax, I would put him on regularly. And as we would do this left versus right segment, where somebody on the left faces somebody on the right, and he would oftentimes be the person on the right. And more often than not, because he was so unhinged, he'd be shouting at people. And he also, I'll be honest, he didn't smell the best, just to go back to our previous conversation. A lot of the left-wing people that we would put him with wouldn't want to work with him. So lo and behold, they arrested him yesterday for participating in this. Oh, and he also sought the Libertarian nomination for president, and then he ran for state senate as a Libertarian. He was charged in a complaint with 4 counts that accused him of being in the Capitol illegally as the riot unfolded. He was released from custody. You might be listening to us right now on his own recognizance after appearing before a magistrate judge. Maybe we could try and get him on the show, but the reason they caught him is because he posted on Instagram and other forms of social media. He posted photos and videos of himself storming the Capitol. Now, here's a pro tip, folks. If you're going to break a law, even if it's something that you don't consider serious, like trespassing at the U.S. Capitol, do not take photos of yourself doing it. If you ignore my first pro tip, then at the very least, don't post those photos on social media. So this case against Daniel Christman is among the latest to be brought in what a prosecutor described during the hearing yesterday as the largest prosecution the Justice Department has ever undertaken. Now, while I may think that this January 6th commission is a little bit of a waste of time, I am all for prosecuting the people that did this. I say prosecute them all. Go after all of them. That's one of the reasons I don't think we need this commission. We have a criminal justice system where we charge people that break laws. We charge people that commit crimes. We give them a trial. They all have the presumption of innocence. And if they can be proven to be guilty, then they pay a penalty or they go to prison. I don't know why you need a commission for this. Do we need a commission for every crime that gets committed? For every riot that breaks out? I don't think so. So, I am all for, even though I know this young man a little bit, I am all for throwing the book at all these people. I say prosecution, yes. January 6th commission, no. That's where I come down. 800-848-9222. Joseph is in the Hudson Valley. Hello, Joseph.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I shower about, like, you know, like every other day. But the reason why is because, like, when I take a shower, I like to shave in the shower. So it opens up my pores, and it makes me get a really, really nice clean shave. And then, like, once I rinse off and everything, you know, like, then I'm all clean anyway.
Yeah, I like to shave in the shower, too. And that's one of the reasons I think I shower so often. But
yeah.
I don't shave every day. I usually sometimes will give my face a little bit of a break on Saturday, on maybe even on Sunday. I didn't shave today, I'll be honest, because I thought that, you know, I actually ran out of the shave gel that I use. So I didn't shave today. I didn't shave today anyway. But I hear what you're saying. That's a fair point. So you shower every other day.
Yeah, well, like, you know, like, I don't, like, shave every day. So, like, I shower and shave probably about, like, every third day, I would say. You know, I don't know.
All right, and why do you shower every third day rather than every day?
I got three doors. The bathroom's not always open.
Well, that's a pretty good answer. That's a pretty good answer. All right. Well, thank you very much for the call there, Joseph. 1-800-848-9222. So I gave President Biden a great deal of credit when it came to taking troops out of Afghanistan. I thought it was great when President Trump tried to do it. And I think it's great that President Biden is following up on what President Trump tried to do. I think it's great to try and take as many troops as possible out of Iraq as well. However, we're now seeing Biden exercising his war powers in other places, namely Syria and Somalia. Last week, and I don't understand why this story didn't get more coverage, but last week, the Biden administration invoked the 2001 authorization of the use of military force, which the president has said he wants to get rid of and replace. So understand, President Biden, who says he wants to get rid of this 2001 resolution, used it last week. He used this resolution to legally justify airstrikes against Al-Qaeda affiliates in Somalia. There are a lot of Democrats who are just livid with the invocation of this authorization of the use of military force, which they said was a legal stretch and undercuts Biden's position on the status of that authorization. Senator Ben Cardin, a Democrat of Maryland and a top Foreign Relations Committee member, said, quote, "I think President Biden should submit a new authorization for the use of military force and should recognize that the 2001 AUMF should be terminated," close quote. Senator Cardin is 100% right. How can Biden be saying this resolution ought to be, or this authorization ought to be revoked, while at the same time he's using it? So clearly he's found some use to it. Senator Chris Murphy, a Democrat of Connecticut, a longtime congressional war powers advocate, said, quote, "If you want to be involved in hostilities in Somalia for the next 5 years, come and explain why that's necessary and come and get an explicit authorization. This idea that that's too much trouble and that's too much to ask is a very dangerous precedent for Congress to set." 100%. Absolutely right. Senator Murphy, a Democrat, is right. Senator Cardin, a Democrat, is right. If Biden wants to go bomb Syria because Al-Qaeda's there or for any other reason, he ought to come to Congress and ask for an authorization to do so and say, here's why. Give me authorization for the next 5 years to go and attack Syria. Because if he's still using this 2001 authorization, these essentially, he's saying these authorizations never end. But I don't think that makes sense. Otherwise, the Biden administration wouldn't be seeking to do that. So that's where I come down on it. I'd love to hear your thoughts. 800-848-9222. And the same situation in Syria. He carried out airstrikes in Syria as well. And I was critical of Trump for these Syria strikes as well. But because we are keeping troops in Syria. So Biden is pulling out of Afghanistan, pulling some troops out of Iraq. But we are keeping troops staying put in Syria. There are 900 U.S. troops there, including a number of Green Berets, and they're going to remain in Syria to continue supporting, air quotes, and advising, air quotes, the Syrian Democratic Forces fighting the Islamic State. Get them out of there. Get them out of there. You know who's doing a good job fighting the Islamic State in Syria? Bashar al-Assad. So if you're serious about fighting the Islamic State, Bashar al-Assad has taken a take-no-prisoners approach. And I'm not an Assad partisan. I don't like Assad. I think it's crazy what he did with this fraudulent election he just got reelected in. But if you want to keep troops there, I don't think that's the right move. I don't think it's the right move in the least. So I would love to hear your thoughts. 800-848-9222. I realize that these troops are not necessarily on the front lines in combat roles. But still, in my view, having American troops in a country like Syria, which is a hotbed of terrorism, only serves to create more terrorist targets. And it only serves to create more terrorists who are upset about what they perceive to be an American occupying force. These American forces in Syria have come under fire several times in recent weeks. Troops at the Al Omar oil field in eastern Syria were attacked by a drone on July 7th. And in a separate incident, hit with multiple rockets on June 28th. Now, these incidents were all part of a series of attacks by Iranian-backed militias against Americans in both Iraq and Syria. If we didn't have troops in Syria, if we didn't have troops in Iraq, they wouldn't be being attacked by drones. Last year, Russian forces repeatedly encroached on U.S. troop-controlled territory in eastern Syria. Why do we have U.S. troop-controlled territory in eastern Syria? Syria, the last time I checked, is a sovereign country that doesn't want us there. Why are we controlling portions of a separate country that's completely sovereign? I'd rather have those 900 troops at the border telling people not to come in unless they're coming in legally. 800-848-9222. We'll do 15 seconds of fame in just a minute. Jeff in West Islip. Hello.
Hey, Frank, you know, we're pulling all of these troops out of the Middle East. Are we going to get in another 9-11 debacle or what? Is the FBI going to pick up the slack? You know what I mean? Well, or we got to have guys over there looking.
Well, first of all, remember, one of the key causes of 9-11 was because we had troops in the Middle East. It's called a blowback. And Donald Trump had it right when he said that. Rand Paul had it right. Ron Paul had it right. I think troops in the Middle East actually makes America less safe. I don't think it makes us more safe.
Wow. Well, Donald Trump kind of cleaned up ISIS, don't you think?
Yeah, 100%.
And the JV team. Remember the JV team?
Exactly. You remember that, right?
Cutting heads off.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Jeff. 800-848-WABC. Jim is in New Jersey. Hello, Jim.
Frank, germs are good for you.
Agreed. So how often should I bathe myself, and how often should my child bathe?
I think you should bathe regularly. I think the problem's going to be all the hand sanitizer. Like, people are just using that stuff like crazy now.
Yeah, I agree with you. That is a problem. A big problem.
Killing all the germs in another year or two, there's going to be big problems.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you heard, earlier in the week, I read the story about why it was in the New York Times, why this is the worst summer cold you've ever had. And apparently people's immune system, now that they're being exposed to people, it's all haywire. They can't fight off these normal colds.
I see these people using hand sanitizer. I'm just shaking my head.
Yeah, I think you're right.
There's going to be big problems in a couple of years from now.
I think you're right about that. Thank you, Jim. We'll do 15 seconds of fame in just a second. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. I'll tell you something that will help get the toxins out of your body, not out of your skin, but out of your gut. And that's where a lot of problems begin, in your gut. And it's very important for you to have healthy gut bacteria. Life Change Tea. Life Change Tea is a mild cleanse and a daily detox that will cleanse you from the inside out. Their slogan is, the tea that makes you go. You can read the testimonials for yourself at getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. And use the promo code Frank when you order. There's a lot of other great supplements on there as well. Stuff that's good for your immune system, stuff that's good for energy, stuff that's good for your vision. It's all on GetTheTea.com. And if you use the promo code Frank when you're on there, you will get to enjoy free shipping anywhere in the United States. The website is GetTheTea.com. The promo code is Frank.
I was born in a city that they call the Windy City. They call it the Windy City because of the Hawk. The Hawk, the almighty Hawk, Mr. Wind, takes care of plenty of business around wintertime. The place that I lived in was on a street that happened to be one of the dead-end streets, where there was nothing to block the wind, the elements, nothing to buffer them for me, to keep them from knocking my bed down, Jim. I mean, really stocking it to me. When the boiler would bust and the heat was gone, Jim, I had to get fully dressed before I could go to bed. Of course, I couldn't put on my goulashes because they had buckles on them, and my folks didn't play that. They said, don't you tear my bed clothes with some goulashes on. But I was fortunate. As soon as I was big enough to get a job and save enough money, get a ticket, catch anything, I split. I said, one day I'm going to return, and I'm going to straighten it all out. And I'm about ready to go back now.
Dead End Streets, a classic, great music, and a great monologue in it. 800-848-9222. We're going to do 15 seconds of fame in just a minute. What I'd like you to do before we do that, now 15 seconds of fame, if you're not familiar with it, is an opportunity for you to be heard for 15 seconds. So all you have to do is dial 1-800-848-9222 and you can be heard on any subject for 15 seconds. It's 1-800-848-WABC. In the meantime, though, what I'd like you to do is follow me on Twitter at Frank Morano. That's Frank MORANO. You also have to follow the Facebook page at facebook.com/MoranoFan. That's where we post the podcast every day. And that's where I post a lot of articles relevant to the topics that we do each day. If you're on Facebook, you should also consider joining the Facebook fan group. That's Morano Radio Fans and Haters. That's MORANO Radio Fans and Haters. We're looking for people that want to have a constructive dialogue about the show, not necessarily just be nasty for the sake of being nasty. Without further ado, it's time for
The Other Side of Midnight. This is 15 Seconds of Fame.
All right, let's begin with Neil on Staten Island. Hello, Neil.
Frank, how do you bathe anyway? I mean, you got to move two cat litter boxes, then you got to get back in the toilet, then move the boxes back and forth. If I were you, I'd never bathe.
It makes sense. Thank you, Neil. E. Frank in Astoria.
Yes, I just want to know something. Is President Joe Biden aware that he no longer works for former President Barack Obama? When is he going to understand that Barack Obama is not the president no more?
Well, I couldn't tell you. Let me say hello to Gary on Staten Island.
We're getting ready for the next January 6th. The best defense is a good offense. It's time to change the conversation. It's time to go forward. Make America great again. Fight for Trump.
Thank you, Gary. Rola in New Jersey.
Yeah, Joe finds the reason why the COVID spiking in the southern states. Let's not get lied to anymore. It's the Democrats that are causing the COVID. Also, Frank, forget the question. Get Andrew Dice Clay. I haven't seen any comedians around lately.
I'm working on it. Tyrone in the Bronx.
Yes, the comment I made about the Barry Corbett show that night, coming down in the elevator, after I made the comment that there was a lot left to be desired, the elevator became quiet, and I was never invited back again.
That's very funny. 800-848-9222 if you want to jump on board for 15 seconds. Zach is in New Jersey.
Yeah, Frank, I agree with you. They should just go straight to court. Forget about the committee. The committee only shows you how afraid they are of Trump still. And they should lock up Black Lives Matter and Antifa for the first insurrection when they put like about 25 to 30 police officers in the hospital. Nobody talks about the first one, huh?
Thank you. Irishman in the Bronx.
Read the Janine Machine by Richard Blasberg and Twisted Justice at CNN.com. That's the Janine Machine by Richard Blasberg and Twisted Justice at CNN.com. Janine Pierre is a criminal and a fraud who sent an innocent New York City cop to prison.
And Evelyn in Bayonne.
Frank, a book recommendation. Someone is hiding something. What happened to Malaysia Airlines Flight 370? One day, I could not believe it. That's my book recommendation. Someone is hiding something. Thank you.
All right. Well, that is pretty interesting. I think we'll probably end it there. Thank you, Evelyn. I've always wondered about that Malaysian flight. And I think that would be a good subject for a Midnight Files segment. We'll look into that. All right. Meantime, coming up in just a minute, we are going to bring you the 77 WABC early news. That means 77 seconds of news from Deb Valentine and then 2 hours. No, not 2 hours. 90 minutes of news from Juliet Huddy and me. We've got business. We've got sports. We've got weather. We've got traffic with Joe Nolan on the sevens. We have everything you need to know. If you want to stay in touch with me, you can email me at frank.morano@wabcradio.com. That's frank.morano@wabcradio.com. Or you could follow me on Instagram at Morano Vision. That's Morano Vision. We would ask that you subscribe to the podcast of this show. We're going to start launching an original podcast next week of stuff that's not heard on the radio. So subscribe to both The Other Side of Midnight and Frank Morano, wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, Google Podcasts, wherever. Subscribe to both of those. This has been a lot of fun, folks. And the WABC Early News is next. To be continued.